to do that. We're already going. Okay, we will call this meeting to order at 6:06. Good evening, everyone. As always, we will begin with attendance. President Kuzmu. Vice President Chellen.
Present.
Vice President Woods.
Yep.
Vice President Lay.
Present.
Vice President Lau.
Present.
Governor Kelly.
Present.
Councillor Battelle.
Present.
Councillor Borden.
Present.
Councillor Mills.
Present.
Councillor Hanwell.
Present.
Councillor Bannister.
Present.
Councillor Schiavone. Is Councillor Muhammad here, or is Ms. Kinda already proxying? Okay, so while Councillor Muhammad's here, he's here, but then you can proxy once he takes off. Councillor Grilke. I believe Councillor Grilke is here. Yes. Yeah. Okay, Councillor Minarski. She's by Skype. Councillor Minarski.
Present.
Councillor Valdez.
Present.
We'll mark President Kuzman here. Councillor Corbett. Councillor Redmond.
Present.
Councillor Hamid. Councillor Morris.
Present.
Councillor Nguyen.
No. Yes, sir.
She's not here yet, no. Councillor Champagne.
Who's that?
Councillor Speakman.
Present.
Councillor Hodgson.
Yeah.
Councillor Huang. Councillor Zhang. Councillor Grahan.
Present.
Councillor Binchik.
Here.
Councillor Douglas.
Yep.
All right, not a whole ton in the way of announcements, just a couple of notes. So you will notice there's a presentation on the late ads, item 2C. I'm going to make that a special order and move it on to the main agenda because it would be rather rude, I think, of our guests if they came and attended tonight and we didn't let them speak, or at least put them on the order paper. Additionally, and I'm going to start making this a general practice unless anyone has any objection to it at the time, for presentations being given by external folks, I'm going to special order them and move them ahead of presentations being made by members of council so that our guests, if they're here, can have the presentations first and then we can carry on with our meeting. So as a result, as I mentioned, I'm going to special order item 2C on the order paper and I'm going to have it immediately follow item 2A. Also, just a minor change to the wording of item 7A on the main order paper. That currently reads, Hodgson moves the approval of the 2012-2013 auditor's report. It's actually going to read, Hodgson moves that Students' Council approve the 2012-2013 draft auditor's report and year-end financial statements. Any questions on that? I will repeat it when we get to the appropriate time as well. If not, I will just make sure we aren't doing any questions. Give me one second here. I'm going to add Councillor Nguyen to the conversation here. With your smiley face. Okay, with that, we will move on to item 2A, student group policy changes, sponsored by Vice President Lau. Do we have a seconder to that? Thank you, Vice President Lay. Any objection to hearing this presentation? Seeing none, we will proceed with the presentation. Come on up. I'm not sure if that's Councillor Grilke or Councillor Nguyen, but if you wouldn't mind muting your mic, just because we can hear all of your minor movements.
We have mics here. Before we get started, are we excited about our new mayor?
Yeah.
Very cool, and I totally love the fact that they mention that he was a U of A student every time they talk about it. Okay. As you can see, I'm not Norma and Deb. Norma has fallen victim to the norovirus, and rather than postpone, I thought I will try to channel her, but I'm going to start with an apology because this is not my main area. So I can speak to some of it with great authority, and some of it I'm just trying to remember from my conversations with Norma. So I'm happy to take questions along the way or after the presentation, either way. If there are any I can't answer, I will absolutely make sure that Norma gets them and gets the answers back to you. Okay, so we'll start out. I guess I should put this on a display. Okay, so starting with the current state of student groups. The student groups register primarily with the university through the Office of the Dean of Students. And then they also, some of them also register with the Students' Union, and some of them also register with the Graduate Students Association. But the face for the student groups is Student Group Services, which is a partnership between U of A and the Students' Union. And that is currently who does all of the sort of administration of student groups at the moment. Currently, the only rules we have about student groups are in the Code of Student Behavior, which, in my opinion, has always been a little bit bizarre, because the Code of Student Behavior is a, you know, don't do this document, and if you do this, you will be punished. So why we're throwing student groups in there, I think it was simply because they didn't know where else to put them. We didn't have a policy home for them at the time. And so you'll see a long list of things. These are sections in the code that pertain specifically to student groups. You don't have to read this if you don't want to, but it's simply the two appendices, and one is about registration. The second is about lots of other stuff, and it's a bunch of, you know, sort of a dog and breakfast of things thrown in together. In addition, student groups are subject to a bunch of UAPL policies, including space management policy, like booking for events, outdoor booking procedures, posting announcements, canvassing and solicitation, alcohol policy, off-campus travel policy, and trademarks and licensing. So right now, it's just sort of all over the place. Student groups who are registering and trying to figure out how things work are kind of on their own. Currently, student union bylaw, and William can probably speak to this better than I can, but I'll do my best because his mouth is full. 3/4 of executive must be undergraduate students. President and treasurer must be undergraduate. The constitution that abides by student union legislation, so it has to accord with all the student union rules. Membership has to be at least 2/3 undergraduate. And they get some additional benefits from the students' union, like booking tables, rooms and sub, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how it works with the undergraduate student groups. Graduate Students Association also has an arrangement for the graduate student groups. 3/4 of the executive have to be graduate students. At least 2/3 of the members have to be graduate students. They follow a student policy through the Graduate Students Association, and they receive some additional stuff from Graduate Students Association. Those two things, by the way, are not proposing to change. Those will continue as they are. Campus Rec also has a stake in some student groups. So any student group that wants to register that has anything to do with physical activity also has to register through Campus Rec. And I think the main reason for this, and I cannot speak with any authority again, but I think the main reason for this is that Campus Rec runs its own programs and don't want duplication. They don't want student groups starting up a program that does something that they already offer. Okay, student group activities tend to have to need insurance. Most of them are covered by U of A insurance, the insurance policy that we have. Some require additional insurance, depending on what they're doing, depending on what, you know, if they're traveling, if they're holding alcohol events, etc. As the risk goes up, insurance costs go up as well. So they need additional insurance as they're doing riskier activities. So student union groups also have access to the student union insurance policy, GSA group, etc. They have access to the GSA insurance policy. So why are we proposing a change at all? Well, a few I've already kind of touched on. These policies are sort of all over the place, and they're not really pulled together in one place. There's a lot of confusion about how this works. Information is not that easy to find. And I will say, Student Group Services is working very hard pulling this stuff together already. So a lot of these changes are not policy changes. They're simply in streamlining the way things are operating. Student group executives turn over every year, so we can't make it difficult for student groups to figure out how to transition from one year to the next. So the idea is to streamline processes. The other idea is that the Code of Student Behavior is about disciplining students, And we don't see student groups as a discipline issue. This is something that, we want to support. We want to make sure that student groups happen and have the support they need. Putting it in the code is a strange thing to do. And we really need to distinguish the difference between administrative things, like helping out student groups, and disciplining students, like, you know, if you break a rule, you could get a sanction. So, also, the information that is currently in the code of student behavior is strange and out of date, and oddly worded. So we knew we had to do something, either to update the code of student behavior, or just to look at the whole way we deal with this question. So, proposed changes. We want to remove student groups from the code, full stop. We want to have student groups have their own procedure. Now, I say procedure because it's not really a policy. So what's the policy? Well, it doesn't exist yet. We are going to be working on what will be, you know, lovingly referred to for now as a student policy. But it will be the sort of high-level sort of policy statement that says the university is committed to providing the students with the best experience they can have. And it'll have some nice little flowery language around that. And under that will be the student groups procedure, potentially a student housing procedure, some other procedures that are needing a home right now. But that's the reason it's a procedure instead of a policy at the moment. But we do believe that it doesn't belong in the code. So one of the things we want to do is look at the preamble from Appendix 1, which is a lovely statement about how we support student groups. We also want to make sure that the responsibilities and benefits to registering as a student group are clear. So those all just migrate directly from the code into the new procedure. But there are some changes. So different requirements for registration. The faculty associations, Greek residence associations, groups with external affiliates, and maybe others. So there are some student groups that are more than just clubs. Some of them have different functions. Some of them are representative. Some of them have other kinds of functions. So in those cases, there may be slightly different registration requirements, but it's still the same kind of recognition. The proposal also includes the idea that all of the executive members must be students. Now, this is going to be pretty much not a problem for most student groups. There are a couple that do have non-student executive members, and so Norma and her group will certainly work with those clubs to figure out how to grandfather them in or how to set up, for example, non-voting ex officio positions on their executives so that those non-students can stay on and still have a voice, but not necessarily a vote. The reason for that is simply because these are student groups and we want to make sure they're entirely student-run. It only makes sense to us. And then we are also proposing some mandatory training and orientation for executive members, and that is simply to make the transition a little easier. We're not counting on the previous year's students to do all the training for us. We'll provide it. The registration procedures will change just slightly in terms of clarifying the timeline. So instead of registering at the same time every year, they will register within 3 months after their elections so that they hold the elections and then the new executive gets registered as the group. Does that make sense? Okay. There's also some elements, as I mentioned before, of risk management. So we want to make sure that it's clear when students need extra approval for events and things like that, and when they need extra waivers or insurance or things like that. So there are times now where student groups are planning an event and suddenly they find at the last minute, oh, we're supposed to have insurance. So partly this is about trying to get that up front to the students so that they know how, you know, if we're going to hold this kind of event, these are the kinds of steps we need to take. And of course, you know, the references to the other policies that students need to know are going to keep them all in one place. Okay, so over the last year and some, we have been drafting this new procedure. There's been a bunch of consultations, student groups, presentations at COSA, RHA, Greek President's Meeting, Campus Law Review Working Group. So we're going to start going through the approval process through governance, and that means getting this thing approved and operational for the next coming year. That means campus law review on November 28th, then from there to GFC executive, to GFC and the board, learning and discovery committee. And, you know, apparently it's a big change in the sense of having a whole new policy. So all new UAPL policies have to go through a pretty serious vetting process, which is fair. It's not a huge change in terms of how things operate. So in terms of how student groups run, it's not going to change a lot. This is much more just background information. And hopefully implementation for the next registration round, which is April and May 2014. So I wanted to talk a little bit about this business of taking out the disciplinary, because this is something that we originally had thought about removing just the administrative side of student groups. So we would still have the power or the option of charging student groups under the Code of Student Behavior, which we can now. And that proved to be more complicated than we thought. And as we thought more about it, we thought, why do we need to discipline student groups? It's a totally different function. It's a totally different relationship between student groups and the university. So, for example, under the Code of Student Behavior, we've got a disciplinary process. It is, here's a list of things you cannot do, and if you do them, here's a list of punishments you could get. That's how the code works, and then there's a whole bunch of procedure and stuff. Under the student group's administration, what we've got is, here's a list of things that you can do, and if you do them, here's a list of benefits you get. So already you can see that these things are not like each other. They are just simply not. The relationship is quite different. So again, if you go to the code, we're grounded in individual rights. If someone is charged under the code, the first thing you're going to see in the code is a list of rights. You have a right to an advisor. You have a right to an unbiased hearing. You have a right to this, that, and the other thing. A whole bunch of stuff. And it's not that we don't want to accord rights to student groups, but the individual rights are because they're having a privilege taken away. If they get a sanction, they're having a privilege, or having a right taken away, pardon me. On the student group side, it's benefits. We accord benefits if you do these things. So if you register and get your executive in place and write up a constitution and do up a budget, you can get registered and recognized as a student group. So again, it's a totally different kind of environment when we're talking about it. Under the code, the decision maker is slightly unclear. This is one of the things we were talking about when we first started talking about what do we need to do with student groups. Because right now, the code doesn't say who is the decision maker. It says the dean of students could be. It also says the discipline officer could be. So I, as discipline officer, every time I got a student group case, which, by the way, I've been discipline officer for 9 years, and I've had only a handful of cases of student groups. So we're not talking about a huge number of clubs here or groups. We're simply talking about the occasional one. And of those, only one has resulted in suspension of that student group status. I think you all know who this is. It was public, so I can say it. Every time I got in a case relating to a student group, I would have to phone up the dean of students and say, well, have you been involved in this? Should I take it? Should you take it? Which one of us is going to do it? That's already a problem. That already creates a bias within the system, which is one of the things we promise you don't get, right? So we had a problem there. So that was one of the things. Under the new student group procedure, the dean of students is the decision maker. Under the code, there's support for an accused. And by the way, under the code, a student group is not separately defined. A student group is a student, which is also slightly awkward. And I mean, sort of the other way to think about this is, you know, a corporation as a person. So, you know, there's precedent for it, but it doesn't work very well, especially in a system like we have. So under the code, student groups don't get any special support. They simply get what any student would get, which is you get an advisor potentially from student service or from student legal services or anyone else you choose to bring as an advisor. But that person cannot participate in the actual discussion so much. They're there to support and to make sure that the process goes as it should. Okay. Under the new system, you've got student group services, you've got the student group's coordinator and the student affairs officer all working with the student group to help them and to support them through getting their recognition and their registration and making sure that they have the support they need to do the things that, that are required for recognition. So again, it's a different response. And I will say again, this isn't a huge difference in practice. These services and these people are already there, but they're officially not allowed to intervene under the code. Once a case comes to my office from the code from Protective Services, I can't talk to them about it. So this is a different system again. And then finally, appeals. Appeals of the code decisions go to the University Appeals Board, which is an administrative tribunal. It's a faculty member and two students. These things can take a very long time to organize. So we have a timeliness problem. This is one of the other reasons for us considering this. We had student groups who, for example, had a decision that they weren't allowed to hold a particular event or activity, and then they wanted to appeal it. Well, by the time the appeal is scheduled, it's long past. So we have a fairness problem there, too. So the new proposal gives actually two steps. The first is what we call a request for reconsideration. So what happens when the dean of students makes a decision to say, I don't think this should happen, there's too much risk to the university? He has to give reasons. And so, and I say he because it's a he now, I'm not trying to be gendered. He has to give reasons to the group. And then the group has a chance to go back and address those reasons. So that's why we do first step to the dean of students again, request for reconsideration. Here's what we're going to do to address your concerns. Now can we hold our event? And the answer could very well at that point be, sure, great. And that student group will have the support of student group services and the student group's coordinator to do that. If, in fact, at that point, the dean says, no, you know what, it's still too much risk to the university, then they can go to an appeal. And because all of this is based on risk, it's not misbehavior, it's not misconduct, it's all about how much risk the university is willing to take on behalf of this student group. So because it's all about risk, we thought the natural place for an appeal would be the Associate Vice President Risk Management Services. And he, again, is a he. Could be a she someday. He would take a look at whatever the student group's proposing and run it against the matrix that they've developed for acceptable risk. So if you go into the risk management policy, they actually have a matrix that says, here's how much risk we're willing to take. And we are willing to take some. You know, we're not totally risk averse. But that's going to be the new paradigm. It's not about punishment of bad behavior. It is truly about, this is a group that's representing the university, so is there a risk to us? Are we going to have a risk to our reputation or property or our, the members of our community? So that's kind of the formal presentation, and I know you were given a procedure to read. I understand that there have been a couple more discussions about that in terms of one of the issues was making sure that students are involved in the decision making, and so what we have planned, and I don't know if it's written in here or not, but what we have planned is to make sure that when a student group is also registered with a student's union, the dean of students will talk to the student's union about it before making a decision. So they will be involved in those discussions. Same for those groups that are with the GSA. If we have an issue with the student group who is also registered with the GSA, then the GSA will be involved in that decision. So let me throw it out for questions.
Moderate questions.
Sure.
Okay. Councillor Binchik.
My first question is quite general. Excuse any lack of knowledge if my being from Braden into it. But in the first place, how come individuals who do get a student group into trouble, how come they are not disciplined as an individual? How come we need a series of new policies just to address that individual as a group?
Ah, it's a really good question, actually. Sometimes individuals are charged as well as the group. So anytime there's an incident that involves a group, the first assessment is, was this individuals or was it the group? And sometimes it's both. So we do look at individual charges. If there's something that was outside of the group that this individual took on and shouldn't have, we can certainly do that as well. That, by the way, will still be the option if something happens involving a student group. We still have the option of individual charges. We will simply not have the option of charging the group under the Code of Student Behavior.
Councillor Champagne?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thanks for the presentation. I have a concern concerning the mandatory training sessions. I'm just wondering where... I can see that we want to harmonize and, have uniformity in the training sessions and make sure that, the next exec is, completely useless. And, make sure they have, a basic set of skills. But I'm wondering, the variety of different student groups we have and considering we have, student groups like at Campus Saint-Jean, which, could all be speaking French for,
right.
How are we going to be able to meet those needs of variety and differences?
Okay, this is probably a Norma question, but I'm going to give it a shot. So, the training is not going to be in-depth and very specific in terms of what each group needs. It's going to be much more broad. So, for example, and I think this already happens, there are certain requirements of training for groups who are holding alcohol events. So that would be one of those things. There may be other sort of leadership training things that are available to student groups that wouldn't be available to people who weren't registered in student groups, for example. But I don't have an answer in terms of which training will be mandatory. My understanding is that it's not going to be onerous. It's simply going to be the changeover stuff so that there's a good transition between executives.
Governor Kelly?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thanks very much for your presentation. I really like the sort of the culture shift. I think it's excellently demonstrated by this slide here. It's not disciplinary anymore, it's more administrative. So I have two questions. One sort of really basic, one a little bit more complex.
Okay.
You mentioned earlier on in your presentation that you're not going to force everybody to register at the same time. And so I guess my question was, so I presume that you're maintaining policy where groups can hold elections at any time as well, and sort of, as I understand it currently, there's sort of an ongoing registration throughout the year. Is that how it is going to be?
That is my understanding, and it could be that, I don't know if they've set up the intervals yet. It might be once a term, or it might be once every 3 months, but essentially making it possible for student groups to form midway through the year.
Fair enough. The thought I had was...
And I will add that back onto the list for the next question, because we have quite a few people. So, Councillor Battelle.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you for the presentation. I wanted to ask about the decision-making and the appeals process. Here, you mentioned that the Dean of Students is the person that would decide in case of a problem or an appeal, but who decides if the group is registered?
The Dean of Students makes the decision about who gets registered. And it's based on that list of criteria. Did you meet these five or whatever requirements to be registered? So it's not necessarily, it's kind of like a checklist more than anything.
But who decides now?
Dean of Students.
Okay.
Yeah, still, so this hasn't changed. What will change is who deals with disciplinary issues. And because we want to take it out of the realm of discipline, it goes back to the Dean of Students. So that's why we've done that. So, for example, if a student group has met all the requirements, the Dean of Students doesn't have to approve each student group. They're going to have an automated system which does that, right? But let's say a student group issue comes up. Let's say a student group holds a rowdy party without an alcohol license or something like that. Then it comes to the Dean of Students' attention. So then and only then does it come to the Dean of Students' attention. And then it becomes a question of, okay, is this student group working within our expectations, or do we need to deal with a risk issue here?
Councillor Hanwell?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you for the presentation. So I just have a kind of a scenario to go through and
sure.
Ask a question about it. So let's say my student group has a problem, goes to the Dean of Students with disciplinary issue, And it's found that we've broken some of the policy, and we go to appeal it, or we go to reconsider it to the Dean of Students Office, and in the end, it's decided that's not an issue, or our event actually isn't contributing to policy. My two questions kind of pertaining to that would be, what would that timeline be like, and what's the difference in that timeline versus the timeline that we have right now?
Can I talk about our current timeline first?
Yeah, sure.
Under the Code of Student Behavior, a complaint is made, it goes to Protective Services, they do a full investigation, they send the file to my office, we end up meeting with the discipline officers, there's only two of us in my office, meet with representatives of the student group. We do an investigation if necessary and come up with a decision. If that decision is going to be appealed, you add on the University Appeal Board. So you could have months, like many months, in a situation like this. Under the new system, it's going to be quick. Meetings. Call you in for a meeting. We got an issue. Let's try and resolve it. Done. So, and in terms of the appeal as well, even when you get down to the highest level of appeal, it can still be done quickly, which was part of our concern that, you know, student groups were not getting timeliness in these kind of situations. So it will be a pretty different look when it comes to actually just meeting up and making decisions, getting things done. Yeah.
Councillor Hodgson?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thanks for the presentation. I was curious because, if I remember correctly, under the Code of Student Behavior, it currently says student groups need to have auditable financial statements, or they're required to have. So I was wondering, will that requirement stay? It is kind of...
I have to look that one up.
Yeah.
There is still a list of requirements, and it's very similar. We need to have a bank account. We need to have at least two signatures on that bank account. A statement of purpose, goals, and objectives about how that money is going to be used. And the maintenance of financial records in proper order for possible auditing. So they've changed the wording. What it means is if we have an allegation of financial impropriety that has to do with a student group, we want to be able to look at the books and see, right? And so if they're not keeping good records, that can cause a lot of trouble, right? So truly, it's about maintaining good records so that if something comes up, it can be verified that they're doing just fine. Right?
Vice President Chellen.
Thanks for coming and presenting all by yourself. I've got sort of a two-part question. One of the new pieces of the policy is that every single student group event or activity has to first be approved by the Dean of Students Office. I mean, I can think of some of the student groups that I've been part of probably run 50, 100 events associated with a group a year. Multiply that by 400, I suspect, because every other counselor here is a part of at least one of the student groups. So, I mean, multiply that by 400 student groups. You've got a big chunk of administrative work on your hands. And so, two-part question. Number one is it's sort of almost a micromanagement of the University of Student Groups. And number two, the way I read how those approvals happen is that it's based on whether it causes sort of a risk to the university. And so, sort of outlandish scenarios. But does it get the university into the business of almost moderating ideologies? What happens if you see an event that could be risky to the university's reputation? Would it a pro-life group or Israeli apartheid group?
It's a great question, yeah.
In particular, if you could also speak to the ideologies or the risk to university finances. What sort of events that groups could hold? And I'm thinking about perhaps representative groups that might say, just off the top of my head, hey, Lucas, come and see the U of A's administrative plan. Would the Dean of Students say, not a student group event, you can't have that on campus? It's just an interesting
question. No, it's a really interesting question, and it's a really good question. So one of the things I want to be really clear on is that the university absolutely believes in freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, all of those things. And we also believe in debate. So no university student group activity or event will be kiboshed simply because of the content. that if there is content that potentially could bring risk, what if they bring like a very controversial speaker onto campus? We're not opposed to that in any way, but that might mean we have to anticipate potential other risks. So maybe the requirement would be, in order to do that, you need to get extra security, right? So now, here again, I'm out of my depth, but my understanding is that it's going to be an automated system which is going to have a couple of check boxes. Are you going to serve alcohol? Check, okay, you need to do this. Are you going to bring in a speaker? Check, okay. You know, those kinds of things. So it's, if the answer is no and no, you know, you don't have someone combing through each and every one of these events. And if they're very low risk events, I don't think anyone's going to have any problem with it just being two check boxes and then we're done, right? So I see what you're saying. Absolutely, we do not want to police the activities or monitor the activities. It's truly about making sure that people have the right licenses or the right permissions to get a room or space, really.
And with that, we've now hit the 30-minute mark, unfortunately. So we will close. Governor Kelly? No? Oh, okay. All right, we will close. Oh, Councillor Mills?
One question.
Yep.
How many people are on the question list?
8.
Whoa. Motion to extend.
Okay, for any particular length of time?
15.
15. Motion to extend. Okay. Motion to extend for 15 minutes. Suspend the relevant rules. Seconded by Councillor Bannister. She's sitting beside you. All those in favor? Any opposed? Okay. Motion carries. We are going until 6:57. 6:58. Councillor Speakman.
Hello. Thank you for your presentation. I am so inspired by my fellow counselors that I don't know what I should ask about. But I think I will ask based on the previous question, and also related to the appeals process, will there be room for student input, let's say if there's like an ongoing sort of policy-based appeal, saying like, let's say you want to bring in a controversial speaker, and then it's like, okay, well, that's fine, you just need more security. And then it comes back with, well, either our speaker disagrees to that, or like we, for whatever reason, are opposed to that. What are the opportunities for student input on changing the policies?
Well, the policies all go through governance. You mean the policies like
that would be in the student group's procedure?
Right, yeah. So if there's something in the student group's procedure that students find is getting in their way of actually holding events or is it, you know, interfering with their right to free speech or something, then absolutely this whole policy procedure is going through the governance process. So any change could be brought through campus law review, GNC executive, etc. So that if, you know, certainly, like any policy, once you put it into effect, you find out how it works, and if you have to tweak it, you can't, but you do it the same way, by bringing changes through governance. So if the students are finding that this is a troublesome policy, they can introduce changes and propose them through governance as well.
Ms. Kinda?
No, pass.
Okay. Councillor Mills?
Thank you for coming to talk to us today. I have a question regarding the benefits that you get from registering and like compared to the current system where it's don't do this or this will happen. With the list of, you know, things that you can do, I would assume that the rules would be a list of things that the university would not approve of.
Yeah.
So is there going to be a similar, you know, don't do this or this will happen? Even though we are giving, are there benefits given to student groups?
It's a good question. There are a couple of things that are in the policy under the definitions. One is hazing. We will never approve an event that involves hazing. One is, risk to persons. So if there's an event that poses a real risk to other students or to members of the university community, that will not be approved. And then risk to property or reputation. So, again, if there's an event that poses one of those risks, then Dr. Robinson will say, no, we're not going to approve this event. And then you go through the usual request for reconsideration, etc. So it's not like it is now where if you do those things, you as a student group will be punished. because we no longer, we're taking you out of the code altogether, right? So we no longer have the ability to charge student groups under the code. What it does is potentially affect your status as a recognized student group. And that's it. So it doesn't take away any rights, it simply removes some privileges. Can I add one more thing? And that is that very, very few of the code issues we've had with student groups have ever ended in suspension of that student group. And that will be the same in the new system, too. You really, truly, you have to do something spectacular to be suspended. And you've probably heard of some of those stories. But in most cases, and I can say this with some authority, in most cases, the most severe result is going to be you have to meet some conditions. And that's it.
Thank you. Councilor Borden?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you for the presentation. So I'm just touching on another thing about the mandatory session in an area, so that's for Norma mostly, but I just want to get an answer somehow, whatever that is.
I'll do what I can.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So would it be the session for learning about the policies and procedures for student groups so that they know how to like fill out forms and that kind of stuff and how to do all these things, or would it be more an exec transition of leadership to make sure they don't have to do their job more so? Because, and I'm just going to say, don't ask two questions in one question, because some students really do mandatory transitions and or have positions that are specialized for that group, so I don't know how that would work exactly, so that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, and again, I'm not going to have a really good answer for you, but my understanding is that the generic transition stuff will be taken by student group services. And some of it will be automated, some of it will be given as sessions. But the specialized transition that is particular to a group, that's up to the group. Yeah.
Vice President Woods.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Just a brief question you brought up. This is more of a specific concern, but one thing that I see out of your guys' office having that final say on whether an event can go through and whether or not the group may require additional resources. I'm just curious, specifically with the resources, what your guys' office is going to do to help with those additional resources. I know the first that comes to mind is campus security. Mm-hmm. If you bring a controversial speaker and when normally you might not require security, I know a campus peace officer is anywhere from $200 to $300 an hour.
Yeah.
Just to have that police officer present.
Yeah.
So how do you, how does your office plan to address some of the additional resources these groups will require in order to follow through on the recommendations that you guys make to them?
That is a darn good question. One for which I have no answer. Now, I do know. I'll give an example. There was a student group a couple of years ago who decided they were going to bring Alison Redford onto campus and arranged it, and that was great. Suddenly, it comes to the attention of the Dean of Students' Office, and they're saying, oh, holy cow, this is a public figure. We have to make sure that there is security. Now, from the perspective of the Premier's Office, university or student group, it doesn't matter. The university is on the hook for that. So, in fact, security did happen, and they partnered up with the RCMP unit, et cetera, et cetera. So, in that situation, I think it was just everybody scrambling to make sure this could happen. And that's kind of how this works. It's like, oh, something's going on. Let's, how do we make this happen? Or how do we deal with it if it can't happen? Okay.
President Kuzma?
Well, thanks all for the presentation. I guess my question kind of resonates with the concerns that Dustin raised in regards to risk, et cetera. One of the things it says is, if a group doesn't abide the responsibilities outlined in Section 1, one of the things they mention is upholding the good name of the university or something like that. And my concern is, what about those student groups that do advocacy? And what if part of the tactics may be deemed as not upholding the good name of the institution, and how would that work with appeals to the Dean of Students' Office and if it's to risk management, whereas originally it was to an appeal board where you'd have student representatives. And so that's kind of a concern in terms of those groups who do advocacy vulnerable and that they could be essentially moved out.
Right? Yeah. No, they would not be booted out, not for advocating, okay? So I think we have to be really clear that we're talking about, if a group, for example, I don't know, one of the faculty associations decides we hate what our faculty is doing, they've handled these cuts badly or whatever, and we want to protest, absolutely they should. That's their function, right? And part of that advocacy job is to keep the university accountable. So we may not love it, but that we are absolutely not going to quash it, certainly not going to punish it. If in the course of that protest they engage in some planned violence or some planned vandalism, okay, now we have a problem. It's not the protest, it's the behavior that's happening around it.
And obviously that's violating provincial legislation to do vandalism. I guess my question is, to uphold the good name of the university seems like a very vague and kind of overbroadening kind of statement.
Yeah.
One's interpretation could be used quite widely, and there's no real appeals process for that.
I see what you're saying. I would say, and other people may answer this differently, but I think the university looks very good when a student group appeals and the university works with them. That actually is a great reputational boost in my mind, especially if the press picks it up. Look, this student group is really unhappy. The university sat down with them and worked something out. Awesome, right?
Yeah.
So in my mind, it's actually a good thing to have that disagreement and that debate. If it ever got to the point where they were either quelling students' ability to represent their groups or were quashing free speech, I personally might get involved in that because I have an issue with it, even though it would no longer be my business.
Councillor Binchik?
What's the timeline for this? When do you expect all the changes to be done and fully implemented?
We hope to get to campus law review next month, end of November, and have the whole thing through so that it's in place for the next registration cycle, next spring.
Councillor Champagne?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question was pretty much say less. President Cruz moves, so I'm going to say that.
Okay.
Governor Kelly?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thanks again for the presentation. My question is unrelated because it was answered from what was earlier. But in my imagining of this new policy in practice, as I imagine exists currently, there are some student groups who won't always register for certain kinds of events or things like that for various reasons. Maybe they don't have time, maybe they forget, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So how have you anticipated... What kinds of things have you anticipated? Because now it's sort of a mandate that they have to register for all kinds of events every event. So how do you anticipate, what kind of behavior do you anticipate in terms of, like, what are they most likely to renege on? Do you see lots of student groups not doing it just because it's a hassle? Have you tried to make it as easy as possible?
Mm-hmm.
And have you anticipated that some groups might say, like, oh, we're doing this event, but they might not include all the information, especially the risky information?
Right.
So how have you kind of accounted for those eventualities?
So that's another Norma question. I probably can't go into too much detail simply because I don't have it. But my understanding is that it truly is designed to be a guide to students who are setting up an event. So, for example, do you need to book a room? Okay, here's who you talk to, right? So really, it's not about registering the event with the university so much as, if you're having this kind of event, here's all the stuff you need. A lot of it's going to be automated online. The only thing I think that will flag, and this is where I'm less sure, but I suspect if the student group decides to hold an event without going through this process, and something happens at this event, then it's going to flag. Beyond that, I don't see that it would necessarily be an issue. It truly is about making sure the student groups have what they need in order to hold their event.
Councillor Patel?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Right now, when we register student groups, we go to their stand, and then we hear the approval from student group services.
Mm-hmm.
So who are we going to hear from in the future, and what's their role going
to
be?
Same thing. It's going to look exactly the same to you. Yeah. So student group services is still intimately involved. They will be the front of, you know, the face that you all see as student groups. But if, for example, if there's a, you know, a highly complicated event or an event that has off-campus travel or something, you may hear from the Dean of Students Office. But other than that, it's just going to be exactly like this now.
Councillor Hodgson?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So I'm not sure whether or not this would result in a
larger workload for SGS, but will any additional resources be provided to SGS to deal with this? Like you just said, they're going to still be the front of all of this. So.
Yeah. From what I understand, it's not going to change much for them. So they're already working on a lot of these things, on automating those things. They've already got a bunch of training in place. It's not going to change much. So I would imagine, and again, one of those questions I don't really know the answer to, but I would imagine if it came out that, in fact, SGS was horribly overworked, something would have to be done. We have, as a university, committed to supporting student groups, and if we don't do it, then we're not doing something that we do. Something will have to be done. So whether that means more support from the university or what, they would have to look at whatever the issue is at the time.
Councillor Speakman?
I pass. Thank you.
Councillor Bannister?
Hi, thank you for the presentation. I have a little bit of a more frothy question. It's not really hard hitter.
Okay.
But since all the events will be registered, will they be publicized in any way? Because it's an interesting thing for an engagement perspective, because that way if we could take all the registered events and make some sort of calendar, that's kind of neat, right? So is there any way to... for Students Union or otherwise to have access to that registration list?
You know, it's possible, and I don't know. I mean, it seems to me like Bear's Den could do that, right? Calendar things, right? It seems like that's already possible. So I don't know if that's been planned or not. I know that Norma has been working very closely with Student Group Services, and that might be one of the things they're working on. I will say probably no to the publicizing events. That will still be up to the student group. But to calendar them, if they're already in you know, the system, I don't see why they couldn't. I think it'd be a good thing to bring up to them.
Okay, with that, we're at the end of the speaker's list and at the end of our time. So I will thank our presenter. Hey. With that, we're on to item 2C, which we're going to next, Council of Alberta University Students Information Session, sponsored by Vice President Woods. Is there a seconder for that? Governor Kelly, is there any objection during this presentation? Is that an objection?
Do you have 4 main points?
Okay, I'm going to take that as no objections. You guys can proceed.
We have things for you, Greg. I didn't send it to you. Oh, I don't care what you say. You stand where you like.
Well, he has to stand where I tell him, but you guys can stand.
Do you want me to go? Okay. I didn't see the rest of your shirt until now, but I think it's really funny. It's over, Corey.
Yeah, I'm still learning my colors.
Don, and I just didn't hear.
Jokes that I'm from.
That's
a good deal. That's a problem because I know we're talking about it as an issue right now.
Okay. I don't care. I will stand where you tell me to stand, Emily. If I'm not being tossed around by you or Justin, then I don't know
what to do.
Mouse or keyboard?
And spacebar?
What's the spacebar? I'm not good with this dang name.
Victor!
The man who creates SUTV.
Yeah. I don't know what he's making.
It is the sun.
Hey, folks. We'll get going. If you're just wrapping up grabbing food, that's no problem. But I will turn it over to our presenters. That's us at 30.
All right, we'll get started. So for just FYI, for those of you who have not had the opportunity to meet these individuals, you guys all know who I am, I hope. At this point, no. Thank you, Councillor Speakman and Bannister. This is Connor Brown. He is the Vice President External of the University of Calgary Students Union, as well as the Chair of the Council of Alberta University Students. He is very tall, which is so intimidating to present with him, but that's all right.
Nailed it.
This is Beverly Easton. She is the new Executive Director of the Council of Alberta University Students. She has been in swing now for about four months. She's pretty awesome. She also ensures that I remain calm when driving in terrible conditions. So we are going to be giving you guys just a brief presentation on what CAWS is, what it does for the students here at the U of A as well as across Alberta, and give you folks an opportunity to ask any questions you might have about the organization. So without any further ado, yes.
Where we started. So we'll try to keep the presentation pretty brief. Can you all hear me? I know it's kind of some noise at the back there with the fan going. This is a picture here of then Premier Rutherford and U of A President Tory breaking ground on U of A campus. Looks a little bit different back then than it does now. The creation of the University of Alberta, if you don't already know, was the first act of the new legislature when it was formed in our province. And it remained the only university in Alberta in our modest PSE system until the 1960s. So the government that we have now, the Progressive Conservatives, have been in power since 1971. And during the 60s and 70s, there was a time of creating a lot of post-secondary institutions. So the U of C, the U of L, McEwen, State, and Nate were created during that time. CAWS was created in 1986, so we're actually quite an old organization. We've been around for quite a while, although we haven't always looked exactly like this. Started out without a staff person, and I think if I'm correct, that used to have the office at the U of A campus. We now have our office downtown right above the Common on 109th Street. That's where I work all day. And that was decided just because we do have three members and we want to make sure that the U of A doesn't feel like they're the favorite child necessarily. Even though we love them and I come and visit
Adam.
We're
known around, the U of A flagship.
Don't say flagship alone.
So it's been an interesting history of post-secondary education in Alberta. Our province is unique in a lot of different ways, and post-secondary sort of plays into that as well. There was a time during the 90s under Klein era, you probably have heard of the Klein cuts. There were a lot of things going on with post-secondary there, a lot of sort of taking back some of the funding that had previously been allotted to universities. We saw the turnover of Klein to Ed Stelmach, the downturn in the economy, and the downturn in the economy plus a lot of other political factors ended up in Stelmach sort of losing out and Alison Redford coming into power. So we've seen some interesting things happening with post-secondary, getting into platforms in the latest one in 2012. Premier Redford had quite a lot to say about post-secondary, but we'll get to later on in the presentation what actually happened with that, which might not be so rosy. And that's sort of what CAWS is, how we, like, where we fit into the landscape, and it was, I guess I didn't mention, but it was created kind of in response to a need to do provincial advocacy, a need for the student voice to be stronger, for us to collaborate together, and to really be able to put forward not just ideas on behalf of one institution, but to be able to leverage our weight as a collective organization.
All right, what's happening?
Petrus, am I boring you back there?
Yeah? No? As you can see on the far right, 17.5%. That is the participation rate for Albertans 18 to 34 years of age, well below the Canadian average, well below the two provinces that we generally compare ourselves to, Ontario and British Columbia. And that's the case for a number of reasons. One of the main ones probably being that Fort Mac isn't all that far away from here. And I'm sure you guys have friends or know people from high school that went up to Fort Mac because there's easy jobs and there's easy money for people coming out of high school.
Next slide.
Yeah. Average undergraduate tuition. Again, if you look at the far right, in 2012, Albertans paying the most in that year. Now, I'm sure most of you guys know that there was a budget freeze, tuition freeze, in March of this year, as I'm sure Adam and Petros have talked about to no end in all of their reports. So that figure is a little bit different this year now because tuition has gone up in a lot of the other provinces, but when you take in into account the fees that you guys pay at your institutions, it puts us right at the very top with other schools across the country.
So what we're what we're trying to present here is kind of why there's a need for such an organization. So as Beverly went over the Rothbein cuts, and we also went over the lowest enrollment rate in Canada, and the fact that our tuition, even without fees, is one of the highest in the country. When you factor in fees, it is one of the, like, it is
the second or third highest in the country, if I'm not mistaken. So what it comes down to is just the fact that in Alberta there's this trend of no one's going to school, and it's really expensive, and ultimately the government makes these random ass cuts all the time that they just decide to do, and then we're in an awkward pickle. So moving on to who cause is. So who we are and what cause is, we represent 70,000 undergraduates to the government, to the public, and to stakeholders. So if you didn't know already, we're a collaboration of the U of C, U of Lethbridge Students Union, and us, obviously. So how cause works and how it actually is made up, it's a little bit confusing, mainly because there's so few members. But you guys are all a member of cause, and that's why it's really important. So you guys are the students right here, and I'll just say, what do you guys do that relates to cause? You tell me what to do. You're my boss. You'd be like, Adam, I want you to be lobbying this, and then I'd lobby that. And some of the times it works. So yes, that goes on to us, which then in turn goes on to cause, the whole organization. I, on behalf of you guys, say this is what the U of A thinks about the policy that's going forward, this is what we should do, yada, yada, yada. From there, it goes to the chair and vice chair, which is actually us. It's actually all him. He's the power right there. I just stand next to him. And then from there, it goes to the executive director, which is our lovely Beverly, who I also didn't mention is actually an ex-VP external from the U of A. So
she was also cause chair.
I was.
See, I love you. And then, so we give Beverly direction, Beverly acts on behalf of the members, and everybody's happy.
And sometimes we also hire student staff. So we're actually in the process of working on that now. And then in the previous years, we've had a student position over the summer months.
Great scan.
If you see me running around the school, tomorrow I'll be around. So say hi.
So that's how CAUSE works.
And then CAUSE also has members of CAUSE. So it comes back to members and ultimately to council. So it's really important for you guys to be top and back, obviously.
You guys got beefs right here.
Now, what do you do for cause? You pay fees, you represent students, this pertains a little bit more to what Adam and Petros do, but it's their job to come prepared to meetings and really be advocates for cause. Get out, lobby politicians. Adam and I gave a presentation to the ministry yesterday, things like that. So you just got to be vocal, be outspoken, and come prepared, and always be participating.
Don't be afraid to be our bosses.
Can I talk more about that or not? Yeah. No. You also do these other things. So the U of A SU does pay student fees, collect student fees, and then some of those fees go towards CAUSE, which we use to operate. We also ask you to take the campaigns that CAUSE comes up with, bring them back to your campus, and make them local. So that's the way that CAUSE works on all of the campaigns that we've done. The idea is sort of arrived at around the CAUSE table, but we really do need the involvement of the campus organizations to help us make that successful. And there's definitely an understanding at the CAUSE table that a campaign, even though it's branded specifically, will look differently at each of the three campuses.
So ultimately, we should need you to participate and tell us what to do, and from there, we come up with ideas that hopefully you can buy into. So
that gets us into a little bit about what CAUSE has done in the past. CAUSE, as I said, has been around since 1986, so we have done quite a lot of work. What we, as we were talking about, hold campaigns, and those are public campaigns that help us to get student issues out into the public arena. And that's important because when we come up on election years, it's important for us to be able to say that this is not important just to students, but it's also something that the average Albertan is talking about. So when there are elections, we usually hold bigger campaigns. And we also put away some of the money from the student fees that we receive to put sort of have a war chest that we will use to hold our campaigns. We also do campaigns and different other activities in response to the political climate and what's going on. This picture here is actually from the March to the Legislature that I helped to lead in my year, back when mandatory non-instructional fees were introduced, which we're still dealing with. So sort of an ongoing thing. We also work quite closely with a lot of other groups. So you might not be quite as familiar, but there are two other organizations out there. Our sister organization, ASEC, the Alberta Students Executive Council. They're a group of student executives from pretty much the majority of schools that aren't within cause. So if you look at the Campus Alberta model, and it has six different boxes, cause is the CARI institutions, the comprehensive academic and research ones, and then ASEC is made up of the organizations that fill the other five boxes. There's also the Alberta Graduate Council, or the AGC, and they have the graduate students from the same organizations as cause.
The grads coalition AGC is just like us, except grad. So it's still the U of C, U of L, U of A, and then Athabasca as well.
Mm-hmm. So you might have heard from Adam in some of his reports about the quarterly roundtable meetings, and that's a meeting that we go to along with ASEC and AGC. So we are working quite closely with them to develop policy positions, develop our asks to government. We also work with the staff organizations, CAFA, ASIFA, other organizations like PIA or Public Interest Alberta. So there's quite a lot of different groups that we're always kind of in touch with.
Certainly.
Anything else to add with that?
You got everything.
Alrighty, so what has cause done? Policy influence. You can see going back to 2004 to 2008, we've had a lot of input in increasing the grants, working on tuition freezes and caps. Changes in voting regulations for students is a more recent thing that cause worked quite
extensively
on. Yeah, that was quite a big project in trying to make sure that voting for students in the last provincial election was something that was a lot easier.
If I might just there, like, and these things are slow. Advocacy is a very slow process. I mean, we talk about the elections thing as a success, and it was a success. It's a success, but we just saw the first polling station, like, in Sup just last week. So this has been worked on. This was a priority like 2-3 years ago, and it was worked on and it was advocated on, but it's not coming to fruition now because that's government. That's how long it often takes for them to reach that point. So.
Yeah, and then over the years, COTS has worked quite a lot on improving access to student aid. So if it's something that you're interested at all in, there's a lot of information out there about the student aid system in Alberta. It is one of the best across the provinces in Canada. And if you were to look at over the years, since maybe the 1990s, where we started and then where we've gotten to the different policies that COS has had, a lot of those things over time, as Adam has mentioned, do come into effect. So there have been a lot of changes. Most recently in the 2012 budget, we saw the elimination of parental contributions, as well as taking into account savings in RRSPs and part-time earnings into the student loan evaluation or assessment. So there's lots of nitty-gritty details about that, but basically we're fighting for student financial aid improvements and seeing a lot of good work happening in that arena. Mostly because we work quite closely with not just the government representatives, but also the ministry staff and the people that are doing sort of the hands-on work with that. Opposition, we have quite good relations with all of the parties. Leading up to the last election, there was also some involvement with the Alberta Party and having meetings with their leaders. So now that they're maybe not quite as much on the scene, we're not meeting with them nearly as regularly, but we do have very good interactions with the Liberals, NDP, and the Wild Rose in terms of opposition. And the Wild Rose actually may be a party that you would think that COS wouldn't necessarily have a very strong relationship with. They've actually pretty much adopted everything that we've suggested could be in their post-secondary policy, which is great. It was an area that they hadn't really developed at all, and then COS came forward and had a lot of good recommendations. We've had some great discussions with them, and they've taken that up, which is really important for COS to be working on with all of the parties, not just picking and choosing which one we think will be the next party in power, which one's the favorite of the day. It's important that across the board, all of the opposition parties are listening to what we have to say on behalf of students, because should they be elected, the policies that they have on their books will form the regulations and the rules that come into play.
And that's also not to say that we don't have great relationships with the BC Party as well. We've met with countless ministers already this year, and we'll continue to do so. We just can't give them as much ammunition in the House to use against themselves, I guess. So they're not as eager to meet with us, I guess.
But that relationship is obviously very important as well. Yesterday, even, we had a meeting with Deputy Premier and Minister Lukaszek, where he actually stayed for the entirety of the meeting, even though he was only slated for an hour, and he answered questions for 3 hours, which was great. So he's got very strong
And COS really dominated the discussion, too. It was really great to see.
And just to add, but with the opposition,
I say so.
We didn't get it. With the opposition parties, we're not just there to give them ammo against the government. We're also there to
certain areas that we wish we'd like for them to go after the government, bring up what the government bring up as an issue. For example, rural and Aboriginal bursaries is something I've been talking about a lot. Opposition members love hearing about that, evidently, as well as Bev said, just with policy. Like, we've been invited to probably every opposition party's party policy convention. So far, we'll probably go to the Wilderos one just because they have a little bit more sway this year. But that's always good that they actively seek us out to, like, we're talking about post-secondary policy, please come. So,
this picture here, just to show you how awesome the talk is. We got a meeting quite a few years ago with Ed Stelmach. This here is Duncan Wutasik, who used to be the former executive director. He was around at Cause for 10 years, which is quite a long time. And they might see, I think, is that Nick DeHaan back there? Maybe.
That is not
it. Okay.
It kind of
looks like a shady Nick DeHaan. Not sure. That's an old picture. And this is from the election campaign from 2012. It was a big get out the vote campaign. If you were around on campus at that time, you might remember. Basically, just to say, here's some of the work that we have done.
Ignite Alberta. This is a collaborative piece between ASEC, AGC, and CAUSE, and it's all about student engagement. And I can't even do this slide justice, so I'm going to give it to the granddaddy of Ignite himself. It's Kufu! No, I'm not even stoked about that. Okay, here he is. You started it.
So Ignite was an initiative, was a two-part initiative to engage not only students across the province on what the future of higher education should look like in Alberta, but also other stakeholders, including university administrators, professors, various academic staff. And two parts. The first part was a conference last year in February 2013, where we published a What We Heard report. We had multiple breakout sessions. We had various speakers. It was kind of hectic at the time. We had two people in the audience here who volunteered and taken a test of that. But it was overall a really neat report that we ended up publishing. The second phase is the overall student feedback, and that has two parts, a survey, which we've sent out to all of the campus, so I hope you folks fill it out and encourage your friends to fill it out as well. And we're also doing doing focus groups on every single campus. So it's the largest student-led initiative of this matter, not only in Alberta, but in Canada, from our understanding, when it comes to this field of higher education, and it's going to be really neat. The ministry is unbelievably excited about it, and the best part about it was hearing from smaller schools how happy they were, because they felt like their opinions were actually being heard for once, and it was really empowering for them. So.
It's a unique project as well, because it's not a group of people having already come up with a set of things that they want to take to students or to staff or to people involved in post-secondary and ask them what they think about something that's already been sort of decided upon, just kind of get that nod of approval. It's something that students were involved in coming up with, and now we're testing it against students throughout the entirety of the province. So if you haven't taken the survey, it does take a little bit of time. It is kind of involved, but you're all very smart people, having sat on this council for some time now. So I would encourage you, if you haven't already, to fill out the survey and to contribute to this awesome project that is going to be wrapping up. Probably the report will be done in December, and then we're looking at doing some sort of a launch event that hopefully we'll be able to invite all of our students to as well in January.
Yes. And a lot of you guys have your laptops, so when Petros is giving his report that no one is listening to, do the survey. It'll take about 15 minutes.
It's an excellent use of your time.
Yeah, exactly. Multitasking. All right, opportunities this year. Opening up the Post-Secondary Learning Act. This is really exciting for us, but it also has a lot of risk involved to it as well. What are you whispering?
I said it's scary.
Oh, yeah.
And exciting.
Yeah, it's really scary and exciting. So a couple things that we'd like to see go into the Post-Secondary Learning Act. We'd like to see an expansion of student representation at the Board of Governors level, so that it's proportionate to the amount that you guys actually pay for your education. Another thing that we'd like to see go into the PSLA is tuition, which is currently regulated. We'd like to see that go into the Act itself, so that that doesn't have to come up every 5 years and that there isn't any uncertainty around it. What else do we want?
We want to ensure the mandatory. There's some kind of an approval mechanism for non-instructional fees, which we'll cover a little bit later, as well as just general areas of student-student autonomy. We want to make sure that we as an SU don't
report to the university in any way that's inappropriate. We should be accountable to you folks and the students, not to the university. So they can audit us. They shouldn't be able to audit us.
And I think some people in the room are involved in the UASU PSLA task force.
Yes.
Thing.
Fellow task forcers.
Yeah, we're also doing one at the University of Calgary, which we're just wrapping up, and they've also done one at U of A as well. So we'll be collaborating all of that, and there'll be a joint document for DICOS. Competitive political environment, we already talked about Ignite. Competitive political environment, this is the first time in 40 years that there's been a real opposition party here in this province, so it's really exciting to see all of the discussions that are going on between the Wild Rose and the PCs, holding the PCs accountable. It's just great to see it, in my opinion. And it's exciting interacting with all of those politicians and getting to hear what they say as well.
Yeah.
Then the last one, I think regardless of what your personal viewpoint is on what's been happening in post-secondary with the cuts and all of the changes that are going on this campus as well as other campuses across the province, it's got people talking about post-secondary. I noticed more this year than any other time before. I'll just be taking the bus or the train, and you're hearing people talking about post-secondary, and it's something that's coming up just in conversation. It's not even something that you have to prompt people to get them talking about. It's a top-of-mind issue for a lot of people, and not just students. What was that noise? Is that anything?
That's just Skype sometimes.
Just checking.
Mandatory non-instructional fees. This is something that Adam just touched on. You guys are all too aware that in 2010, there's a new fee introduced here for $290. We had a fee at UC introduced for $450, and the University of Lethbridge just saw their fee increased by 300% this year. So that's something that's running rampant across the province at every institution, and that's something that needs to be regulated. And what we want to do there is we want a student approval mechanism. We want it to either go to a student referendum, where every student has the opportunity to vote on a new fee or a proposed increase, or at the very least, come to student council, so you guys make the decision. And that's, I'll just continue for one second. I know you're chopping at the bit. And that's really to cause meaningful consultation, which is lacking at every institution. There's no meaningful consultation with students for what benefits them, how much they should be paying for fees, and that would really force our administrations to consult students.
Like your consultation fees. The second point is something that I've, again, talked about a lot here, just restoring non-repayable student financial aid. So, first of all, there's the whole restoring aspect. As I said, there's been some changes between scholarships and bursary. If you're on policy committee, you'll know what I'm talking about. Between 2009 and now, a lot more money is going into merit-based aid instead of need-based aid, which is a huge issue for those that, you know, like need aid and have to work for it and can't get the 4.0, so can't get a scholarship. We'd also like the PCs to just do what they promised and give us our rural and bursary money, or rural and aboriginal funding already, because we asked for that nicely and they said sure, and then they lied. So, I mean, nobody lies, but we'd like the money.
Stable, predictable tuition framework, budget cuts this year, it left our institutions scrambling for money, other pieces of revenue, and that's why we saw fee increases and new fees proposed around the province. So we'd like that to be stable, predictable, and affordable for everyone moving forward this year. Tuition, we'd like to tie tuition to CPI, the Consumer Price Index, which over the last 20 years has been averaged out at 2.4%. In 2004, I believe, we saw an increase to tuition in and around 30%, which is a massive increase, and we don't want to see that anymore, and we'd like to know what we're going to be paying for school for years to come in the future.
And then finally, we're on the last one, all right? Creation of a new student employment program to replace the loss of STEP. Again, this is something you all know that I've talked about quite a bit. That's only been $7.1 million. We're now the only province out of all the provinces and territories of Canada without a student temporary employment program. And it was a great resource for hooking up students to jobs that are relevant to their degree, as well as ensuring they had adequate wages during the summer to actually pay for your education, because as many of you know, working at Starbucks does not provide you with an adequate summer wage to pay for your books and your tuitions and all of the things.
I'm going to just say briefly about our priorities, the way that we come up with them, similar to the U of A Students Union, is that we have a set of policies on our books. Those policies have been decided on and agreed upon by all of our members. They stay on our books. They're actually on the website, which is cause.net, if you're interested in checking out. There's a whole list of all of our policies that you can go and read. If they need amendments, similar process to how you would make changes to your own political policies.
And then we look at the political climate of the day, what we think we'll get the most traction on. And we try to limit it to about 4 to 5 priorities for the year, just so that we can really spend a lot of time working on those specific areas, which isn't to say that if something came up partway through the year that demanded our attention, we wouldn't sort of shift focus. And we're a pretty nimble group, being only 6 people plus staff around the table. So we're able to work quite closely with each other and to be very responsive in getting documents out and responding to the questions that were often asked by MLAs.
And an interesting point for all you would-be externals, but when we come up with our priorities documents, when Connor and I lobby, we don't lobby. I don't lobby on behalf of the U of A students, and well, I do, but when I go to lobby meetings, it's on behalf of the Council of Alberta University students. So we lobby cause as priorities, not the priorities that I ran on. We've got to make sure those are put into priorities of cause. So that's why over the years you might notice that a lot of the externals in a lot of different places have the exact same platform, because we go, oh, well, these things sound like they're going to have traction, and these things sound like we might do well, and this year let's run on this. And
yeah. And we actually have a lobby meeting together tomorrow. So if you guys have any questions, I think there's 4 minutes left.
You guys said you were going to be quick, but I've got 2 VPs externals and a former VP external, so...
We like to talk!
In typical VP external fashion, we have time for a couple of minutes, if anyone has
and
any.
And if you do have questions, you can email us as well, or tweet us.
Itching to hear Petros's report. Councillor Speakman?
I have a question for Beverly regarding, I guess, future questions or issues. What kind of beefs should we bring to the members of FOS that are relevant?
Anything around tuition fees, funding, anything that's sort of an external issue. So a great way to do that is, if you want to have conversations as counselors, I'd always be up to chatting with you, especially looking to next year if you're interested in running for the external position. Great person to talk to would be Adam, but I'm also available as a resource. So if you have those issues, there's avenues through your own council, through talking with Adam, and then Adam can certainly be the voice around the cause table. But if there's specifically an issue that's external focus, that's something that has to do with what the government is doing, so if it's opening the Post-Secondary Learning Act, it relates to any kind of policy area that the government plays into, then those would be sort of the areas that I would be dealing with. So it's an on-campus thing, not so much a cause priority or something that cause really focuses on, unless it was something like, at some point in time, student housing was like a big thing across all 3 campuses, and then caused it a little bit more in terms of that issue, just because it was something that all 3 campuses were really dealing with. But mostly, it's things that the government deals with that I would be responsible for.
And any anecdotal evidence that you guys can provide for us,
absolutely.
If you've had issues, transfers, fees, anything like that, registrar's office, go to Adam.
Loans, grants, financial aid, all that kind of stuff.
Councillor Hanwell?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you guys very much for your presentation. I'm just wondering, so for future goals for Ignite, are you guys thinking at all about kind of generating post-secondary policy between all 26? Is that like somewhere down the line as a potential?
That's something we've floated around a little bit, but it really hasn't come to fruition just because the needs of care institutions are so different than
the rest.
Schools like Bow Valley and places like that don't really quite have the same goals in mind with some of our larger schools. But that isn't to say that collaboration isn't one of our top priorities this year. We've already started a great relationship with ASEC and AGC, and it's really proven to amount to quite a lot of traction with the ministry. I'm pretty much done.
2 things that we are trying to do after Ignite wraps up is to keep the conversation going. So looking at ways that we can maintain the momentum that we've already gained, and then also making sure that the students who were involved in the roundtables who took the survey have something come back to them that's tangible. So a lot of time you just go to a focus group, give your opinions, and then you kind of wonder what actually came out of it. So we're really trying to address that part as well.
Got about a minute left, Vice President Chellen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'll ask the question at my very first council meeting 5 years ago that I think was one of my favorite questions I've ever heard asked in a city council meeting. In fact, I think it was when Deb was VP external. And that is, how much does the SU pay for cause membership fees? And
this
is
what I printed out the fees sheet. So the way that cause assesses fees is that we have an assessment of $1.40 per full-time equivalent. So that's not full-time, some nuance of how you would know, how we define that, being a VP academic. So it's $1.40 per FTE. And then we also look at full-time undergrads, part-time undergrads, and then spring and summer as they're all part-time undergrads. So there's an assessment based on that. If any of the members are interested in that, you could get that detailed breakdown from Adam. The total payment is estimated to be, for this year, around $47,000. So it is quite a lot of money that the U of A pays because the U of A has quite a lot of students. And that is assessed in two payments. So there's a fall installment. And then because that installment portion is paid before the U of A actually knows what their total numbers are, then there's an assessment in the winter that tries to take into account what that is. Although that being said, I should add the caveat that the U of A hasn't updated their data book in about the last 2 or 3 years. So the U of A numbers are actually out of date, and if the U of A were ever to actually release their numbers, then there might be an adjustment to the fee that the U of A pays.
And our fees are only ever increased by CPI, so we really walk the talk. So we want the government to only ever increase tuition and fees by CPI, and we do the exact same thing. And what your fees pay for are the salary, our office space, our cause changeover. And without Bev and an executive director, Adam Petros and I would not be a disaster.
And campaigns. Like we should
and do campaigns.
Heavily.
Yeah, we need to have
campaigns.
Well.
A lot of that we do put aside quite a lot of money for the war chest that we use for campaigns.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And, One more thing. If you guys didn't pay fees, we wouldn't be able to do the awesome stuff like changes to the Act Election Act and things like that. It's definitely worth it.
And with that, we have reached the 30-minute mark, so we will thank our presenters.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Okay. Coop.
If you see me tomorrow, say hi.
And with that, we will move on to item 2B, Peter Lougheed Leadership Initiative, sponsored by Vice President Chellen. Is there a seconder for that? Vice President Lau, thank you very much. Any objection to hearing the presentation? Seeing none, we will proceed.
Hey Council, so unlike the VP externals, I'm going to promise to be brief and I'll try and stick to that promise. What I'm here to do today is to seek your feedback, and genuinely that's what I'm here for, is to seek your feedback around the university's proposed leadership initiative. It's a development that's happened really quite quickly over about a month and a half. I've had some personal thoughts, done some initial consultation on the project, and I wanted to, number one, bring you folks up to speed on what the university is proposing, and number two, ask your perspective on whether or not the SU is taking the right position in response to such a proposed leadership college. So the overview of the presentation, I'll try and cover what's happened, and the way I'm going to present it is, there has been progress toward the development of a leadership college since 2010. The SU, from my understanding, was first made aware that this was a university priority about 2 or 3 months ago when the university contacted Petros for his input around a leadership college. But what I will do is cover sort of the broad history that we found out about after the fact, and then explain where we are today. So back in 2010, Dean of Students Frank Robinson presented to Dean's Council in what he terms a brainstorming presentation. The proposal was, how can we take the current triangle of leadership development that you see there and turn it into more of a rectangle? Now, the rectangle isn't anywhere in the presentation, so that could be part of the miscommunication that's happened along the way. But the idea is, how do we get more students involved in leadership experience? The presentation goes on to posit, what if we built a leadership college? And I don't know if you can see there, but broadly, just a recommendation from Dr. Robinson and Jerry Kendall, the university's registrar previously, was that we should build a leadership college, programming provided, offer opportunities for formal and informal leadership learning, guided by a senior academic sort of principal in residence. Residence open to 150 students, and accommodation space for alumni, guest speakers, honorary degree recipients, etc. Ideas on what the space would look like, and that space allocated there is on Saskatchewan Drive and like 100 and what? Saskatchewan Drive and 114th? 113th? Right next to the Humanities Building. So apparently that was how the conversation started in 2010. Skip ahead a year, University Advancement releases a donor interest paper called the University of Alberta Leadership Initiative, where in it they continue to describe a leadership college for about 300 students was what they were aiming to raise funds for. They proposed about $100 million fundraising campaign. With about, let's check my math, about $40 million? Sorry, about $35 to $40 million for the Leadership College and other pieces for other leadership opportunities on campus. And sorry, for those of you that would like to follow along on paper, if you just check the back page of the third page of your late editions, you can see sort of a discussion paper that I've developed in case you're interested in reading something instead of spending time on Facebook. That leadership discussion paper, or leadership initiative discussion paper that I showed you earlier, by the way, was only made available to donors, people who were interested in donating money. At no time, from my understanding, was that ever shared with the university community or the SU. So let's skip ahead to September. The university president appoints Peter Meekison, former provost and VP academic, to lead the leadership initiative. He's hired to, from my understanding, get a leadership college done and finished. He proposed at the last GFC meeting, based on his consultation with deans, Petros, other senior administrators, other leaders around campus, a 144-person college. Students apply at the end of their second year. They're selected by a small committee consisting of a couple of profs, a couple of students, the principal, and a couple of community leaders, based on both grades and previous leadership experiences in their first 2 years. They then become a part of the leadership college in third year, along with 71 other students. They live in this residence. They take courses extra to their degree. They take a mandatory community service learning experience between their third year and their fourth year. In their fourth year, they take a capstone course to sort of apply everything they've learned. They'll be exposed to speaker series throughout both years. They've got access to leaders in residence, where the idea is in each sort of cohort, there will be a leader from the community that lives with them and mentors them. And then at the end of their two-year degree, they will have a certificate and a specific note on their transcript that they were a resident of this Lougheed Leadership College. Again, two cohorts of students, third year and fourth year students, about 144. The university's goal is to get students from all faculties. One of the things I'm struggling with is how will students in very rigorous academic programs, by rigorous I mean really structured programs, like say engineering, medicine, nursing, which have very strict program requirements, how will they be able to benefit from the minimum four courses required for any sort of certificate? The idea accelerated even further in Deer on the anniversary of the passing of Peter Lougheed, which I believe was September 16th, 2013, announced the launch of the Lougheed Leadership Initiative. It was an exclusive event. I wasn't even invited. So there's a video online if you're interested. It's in partnership with the Banff Center, and they struck an advisory board for this Lougheed Leadership Initiative, which includes the Leadership College. The membership is below. You'll note that no academic staff, no profs, no students, just donors, potential donors, members of the Lougheed family, and then the president and vice president of advancement of the university. In a communication the university president sent to all staff, apparently will support this Lougheed Leadership Initiative fundraising project, will support community service learning, undergrad research, leadership cohorts in residence, Green and Gold Grant and Emerging Leaders Program. I've done some digging, CSL, URI, and Emerging Leaders Program. Haven't heard about that. That apparently they're going to get more funding. And in fact, CSL, URI, and the Emerging Leaders Program are currently in situations where they're struggling to get funding and struggling to plan for the next 2 years, let alone think about increasing their work. Why am I presenting this to you today? Because on Thursday? Thursday, there's a GFC Facilities Development Committee meeting where two things are happening. Number one, changes to the long-range development plan for North Campus are going up for recommendation to the board. And part of that includes specific allocation for a leadership college on Sask Drive and 113th Street. There's also a discussion item around planning for East Campus Village, which includes very, very concrete plans for the building of this leadership college. This is the first slide. The second one, exciting, beautiful building, three-story building with the beautiful spiral staircase and inner plaza for students. Tremendously exciting building, with the caveat that this is an exclusive residence available for 144 of the top leaders and scholars of the university. It's off campus, and it's meant to isolate, in my perspective, leaders on campus. This is going for discussion at GFC this Thursday. So wanted to make sure we could give Josh some advice on this. What's my perspective and what's my sense on the student perspective around this whole leadership initiative? First off, you've got a project where donors are dictating what buildings are being built and what programs are being offered. You've got an advisory committee consisting of no profs, no students. You see a GFC profs raising concerns around a leadership initiative. But yet courses are being designed and a building is being designed with the donor's interests in mind, not the interests of profs or students. I'd like to see this project move under, say, the Dean of Students or the Provost's Office. Number two, I think the university needs to invest in not just building a residence. You don't just build a building for 144 students. But what I'd love to see done with that $100 million is instead devote a portion of it to curriculum development so that students throughout all of their programs and their existing courses can learn leadership skills in immunology or native studies or ALES or whatever your discipline happens to be. I'd love to see leadership skills integrated into the curriculum rather than being an add-on that looks good on 144 students' resumes. Third point, we spent an hour talking about student groups. I think everyone here is probably a part of a student group. My experience is that was the best leadership development opportunities during my time at the U of A. Why don't we support things like SGS, and we've heard that they need support. Why don't we support things like Leadership Summit, Emerging Leaders Program for student leaders? I don't like the implication of a leadership college implying that all of the other residences on campus are, say, follower colleges, and why there isn't plans to devote resources to our other residences. Lister has, what, 1,000 students living there that won't benefit from a leadership and residence program? We also underfund some of our current programs. UFC has this beautiful experiential learning office on the first floor of their Students' Union building that any student can go to if they're looking for undergrad research experience or community placements. They just invested $40 million in building a new building where on the first floor you'll see commitment to experiential learning and undergrad research. We underfund our programs, like I said before, struggling. They struggle annually. CSL, I just attended their advisory committee meeting. CSL's funding is going to go like this over the next 2 years if they don't get extra help. And I'd love to see a leadership initiative complement our already existing leadership development programs rather than try and go and build something new. Last two points are the more poignant pieces that I'm looking for your feedback on. Number one, I don't think that leadership opportunities should be restrictive, exclusive, only available for the best of the best, the 0.5% of students. I think they should be available to everyone, including students living with dependents, students who can't afford to pay to live in an elite, brand new residence, students from other campuses, and I'm talking particularly to Helen and Stephanie right now, and students in strict academic programs who don't have time to take an extra 4 courses and therefore wouldn't be considered Lougheed leaders. The last point is, I don't think, given the tough financial situation we're in, where we're laying off thoughts, our programs, courses are being deleted, the best use of donor dollars is to build a sexy new building for the top 1%. So that's my perspective, but if you have any questions, happy to hear them, but I want to hear your perspective. So,
wow, that was faster. Okay, we do have about 17 minutes or so for questions. Councillor Hodgson?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you for the presentation. I think I share a lot of your sentiments here. I'm curious as to what the
Like, I guess first off, does this have to go to GFC? Because at the last GFC meeting, there was a very negative attitude towards this, and I don't see it passing at GFC unless they make some substantial changes. But can the university just do this without, like, anyone actually voting on it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I met with the university's VP Advancement last week. The point that I started off with is, where are we in the process? And his point to me is, the university administration has made a decision to go ahead with a leadership college. It's going to happen, despite the fact that no governance approvals have been made yet. So he's convinced it's going to happen. Will it go to GFC? It doesn't have to. The building of the facility will be routed through FCC and then up to VFPC and the board. So I'm looking at Vice Presidents Lane and Kuzmu and Board of Governors Rep Kelly. It's up to them on whether or not a building gets built. What the academic program in that building is up to GFC Academic Standards Committee, Academic Planning Committee, and it may go to GFC. GFC can always say, I'd like to have it back. I asked at the last GFC executive meeting to put the Leadership College on the agenda, and Martin said, no, we're not ready yet. So the provost said, no, we're not ready to bring it back to GFC. So it doesn't have to go to GFC if admin don't want it to, and if staff and students on GFC don't want it to. My concern is that if through FDC, BFPC, and the board, a building gets built, we're going to have to put something in it. And the building that they're proposing, which looks sexy, but is concerning, is a leadership college. So, and apparently Petros wants me to defer to him.
Yeah, in talking to the board chair, though, his remark was that if we were going to vote on this initiative today, he would not be in favor of it. He's very up in the air. That's the perception that, that's the vibes that I got from him when I pressured him about this. And he's kind of reassured me, like, yeah, I know, of course, like, we'll vote to an extent, and he's like, yeah, what are your guys' thoughts? So I was like, okay, we'll give your thoughts. So Dustin is leading this, and I'll be sure to pass that on. You know, once we get, like, your thoughts from the Students' Council and from other stakeholders, pass on to the board chair and be like, okay, this is what we're thinking. It's from my understanding that the board chair has the intent of at least wanting to bring this forward through governance, but it's kind of mixed messaging from the administration and from the future.
Councilor Bannister?
Hello, thank you for your presentation. I agree with most of what you said. I have a question. So in the Faculty of Arts, they're now proposing the Academy, which is the Honors College. From my understanding, the two different colleges, the Leadership College and the Academy, which is an Honors College, are unwilling to work together in liaison. Do you have any insight into if, like, why is there two different... They have similar purposes. They're different, but they're not night and day.
I can give some insight. So I met with the Associate Dean of Arts to talk with the Honors Academy of Arts and Science. I was a huge supporter of it when it went through the Tea Leaf Committee, which is Teaching and Learning Enhancement Fund proposals. My perception, I'm not going to speak for the Associate Dean of Arts on this. My perception is that the Honors Academy is really about enhancing the first year academic experience. Let's redevelop some courses for arts and science students to broaden their skills, give them a different range and different level of sort of coursework in their first and maybe a little bit into their second year. It's sort of an academic-based project. A leadership college is a residential extracurricular, co-curricular piece that you get a certificate out of. Take a few more courses out of. So they're quite different. The Honors Academy of Arts and Science is sort of trying to get to every student the first year. This one's only taking the elite students in the third and fourth year. This is sort of how I'm perceiving it. The second issue at hand is the Honors Academy of Arts and Science needs money, and the university hasn't been interested in providing any financial support to an Honors Academy, yet they are interested in providing financial support to a leadership college.
Ms. Kinder?
So I have three questions and a comment. Do you want me to separate all of them?
Depends how related they are. If you can sneak a couple in related,
sure.
Great.
So first question, do students pay extras to be part of this program and live in this college?
I would assume so. My assumption is that students would pay residence fees like they do for any residence. Residence fees typically depend on market rates. I'm not an expert on residence fees, but given that it's a brand new building, I believe the rooms are being built to have more space in them. I would suspect that students would be expected to pay substantially more to be in this residence.
Well, maybe this is kind of a silly question, but do you know what the motivation for this was? Like, why did President...
Yep. Okay, I'm going to have to pause you there, because that's question two, so I'll add you back to the list. Councillor Mills?
Yeah, thank you for the presentation. I have a question around the funding and the donors. I know that with the university, oftentimes donor money is very much tied to the donor and what they want. Is it possible if these donors want to go towards leadership initiatives that we say, hey, these programs already exist, would you be okay if we put it towards DSL? Is that possible, or is it already dedicated towards this college?
You made a great point. That's what my objective is to do, is to help donors realize that, from my perspective, Peter Lougheed wasn't an exclusivist. He wasn't looking for something that would benefit the top 0.5%. That's not why he ran for SU president or premier. And so my goal is, with this discussion paper, to get donors to think about where they're putting their money and whether or not a leadership college is the best place to invest. And what I'm really looking for from council tonight is an indication. And when am I out of time?
10 minutes.
I might, because I can ask for a straw poll in a presentation, can I?
It's your presentation.
I'd love to ask council for a straw poll on whether or not you support the building of a leadership college, as I described earlier, just to get a sense on whether or not I'm on the right track. Just a straw poll, nothing like committal. Just want to see what your thoughts are, whether or not we're on the right track by saying, let's direct money towards these better things, like emerging leaders, student group services, leadership in residence, instead of a leadership college. Yeah, does that answer your question? Let's see.
Councillor Hodgson?
Oh, is that...
Are you going to do this?
In 10 minutes, so that you won't have to ask questions.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yeah, I guess I'm curious at what, at this point, what we can do to derail and or, like, stop, or at least the very minimum, slow this down. Like, is it that the discussion paper you mentioned, the one that was in the agenda package? So you're sending that to donors. Like, what else at this point? Like, can you show we show up at committee meetings and go rattle, 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 or what?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I need to get more advice on how we can change the direction of this project. Number one, I haven't yet sent that discussion paper to donors. My goal is to send it to academics. I've sent it to academic staff, for instance. I'd love to send it to Dean's Council and see what deans of our faculties think. I've heard already sort of under the radar sort of opposition to investing in a leadership college from deans of faculty. So curious to see what their thoughts are. Love to discuss it with the provost. If the vote goes through the Facilities Development Committee without any concerns raised, I'll forward my concerns to the board, I suspect, on behalf of the Students' Union. And if it makes its way with strong signs of support all the way up to the Board of Governors, then I suspect I'll... I think it would be worthwhile better, more clearly communicating to donors where their funds can have the most impact. So that's a rough indication of my plans. Again, like I found out about this a month ago, so...
Ms. Kinda?
Okay. So, yeah. What was the motivation for this? Why are they talking about proposing leadership college? And what is the university hope to gain from this?
Thanks.
In terms of, image and all that, have you thought about...
Yeah, so motivation. Number one, the university does have fewer residences compared to peer universities. We need more spots in residence. I think the SU would probably agree with that. So they want to build more residences. A leadership residence, because the university believes it needs to compete with the best of the best. U of T just opened something called, has had something called Massey College, which is not exactly the same. The one that the U of A is modeling off is more like models at MIT, for example. And so the idea is to compete for those top 0.5% of students in North America and give them another reason to come to the U of A. I think it's meant to enhance our nation and North American-wide institution. The U of A is increasingly comparing itself to American peers, and I think that we're at a point where we want to appeal to the more, or compete with the more privatized institutions in the U.S. I can't defend the university's decision, because to me it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense why we're directing $100 million toward 144 students.
Councillor Hanwell?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So I'm just wondering, and this is kind of a weird question, but Is it your prerogative by any means to talk to donors? Because obviously when you look at that list, you can see that there's people that are probably quite involved in this. And is that, like, too much stepping on, like, shards of glass by going to talk to those donors and seeing their reasoning for supporting this, or...
Yeah, thanks for the question. I haven't considered it yet, and I think it's important that we do it delicately. I haven't considered going and meeting with prospective donors in advance. It isn't clear who those donors are. I would suggest it's probably some of the people on the advisory committee, but I suspect outside of that there are other major donors, which we have no idea, who are interested in supporting the Leadership College or are being encouraged to support a Leadership College by advancement. What I think we can do is... make it public that there are ways that we'll receive donors more thanks from students. I suspect instead of 0.5% of us getting access to a Leadership College, I think we'd all be much more thankful for, say, a $1,000 study abroad scholarship or undergrad research initiative stipends if you want to do research over the summer and aren't being funded. So that's my goal, is to rather than just say, don't do this, say, here's somewhere that students would appreciate more. But yeah, delicate ground.
Ms. Kinda, and I have no other speakers on my list, so you can ask that. Oh, I'm sorry, I lied. Okay, you can ask one more, and then I'll go.
I want to comment, I guess, if you want feedback. So, I completely agree with the SU stance. I think structured programs aren't going to provide us with leadership. Like, for example, I got leadership by doing things, you know, stumbling through things, like figuring things out and talking to peers and friends. I think it's really counterintuitive. It's an exclusive residence, and when I think of leaders and leadership, like, leaders shouldn't be confined to a restricted space. They should be dispersed amongst everyone so that you can bring what you share to your peers and you can, like, you know, talk to your fellow students. What's the point of this? Like, it seems like this leadership initiative, if it's going to have any benefit, it's only going to be for those 150 students, when instead of leadership should benefit everyone. So I think it's really counterintuitive, and I just... don't like it.
Yeah, and I really appreciate those comments. One of the things that someone said to me is, Dustin, why are you opposing this? You would have been a great candidate for a Leadership College.
I would totally join it if it existed. You know, that's the irony here. Like,
I mean, but my point, he said, Dustin, you'd be a great candidate, you're a great student leader, whatever. And my point is, no, like, I wasn't. And at the end of second year, I was trying to slog through my honors math midterms. I was struggling through trying to get a handle on, like, a student group. I was at the lowest level of responsibility for one of my other student groups. Like, I can't... My concern, and I'll be really honest about this, is the people that have the time to have beautiful academic and leadership resumes by the end of second year, the people that didn't have to work to feed themselves throughout university, or who didn't have a dependent that they had to look after in the first 2 years, or that... weren't in a tremendously difficult academic program. That's a broad generalization, but I think leadership is a lot more happenstance than isolating the top people, the top 19-year-olds in a 144-person building. So, with that, just I'll take one more, actually, from Rat, and then I'll do a straw poll.
Kate, Councilor Minarski?
I was just wondering, do we know anything on the cost, like what the cost to attend is, and if they plan on providing any additional scholarships to people who might not be able to afford, who are eligible?
No indication yet on the cost to attend or whether or not scholarships will be available. I'll dig to see if I can find out anything. Costs of building the facility looks to be around, again, $30 million with an extra $80 million for endowing operating expenditures.
And just the second part is, like, do we know on anything about, like, the revenue generated from this, whether or not it's going to be applied in other areas of the university?
My understanding is residents are operated at cost-neutral bases, so they wouldn't be revenue-generating, but again...
For sure it won't be revenue-generating?
I'll check. My understanding is that's standard practice, but I'll check. So, what I'd like to do before I get to someone else's question is quickly do a straw poll around whether or not you think the SU should oppose... for the time being, until we get more information, and I add that caveat, because why I wanted to present to you today is because it is moving through governance very, very quickly, but whether or not the SU should oppose the building of a Leadership College at this time. So, in a straw poll, placards up, who thinks we ought to?
Oppose it or...
Ought to oppose it.
Oppose.
and placards up for those who think we shouldn't oppose it.
Is there undecided?
Yeah, and the last one, of course, is anyone like to abstain?
In the interest of your information, I'll give you.
Cool. Thanks.
In case you guys are kind of curious, the rules sort of go out the window for presentations, since presentations are a construct we developed. Vice President Lau, do you have a question?
I did have one. It was going back to, like, how could we get the message out to donors?
Let's talk in the office.
Councilor Mills.
A silly question regarding the consultation that's happened with the deans and other faculties. Given that they will be expected to provide academic staff to this program, and if they are in favor of this kind of leadership program, as well as what kind of costs it will be to those faculties, and if they can afford to give those faculty members to this program.
Good question. I haven't heard anything yet from the deans around resource allocations. I know all deans are tremendously stretched, so that's why sort of my next step in the near future is to gauge the support of deans for this project. But I encourage faculty associations or student counselors to write and see what your deans' thoughts are around Culture College. Right now, I haven't heard any public opposition from deans, only under-the-table opposition. Just one to Lau's earlier question. I think tackling the donors right now is, as Councillor Hamill said, a tricky situation, sort of like walking on glass. What I'd like to do is, again, talk about that public message around Lockheed instead would have supported a broader, more applicable leadership initiative. But if anyone has any advice on how we convince donors that students would thank them for other things, all ears.
With that, we've pretty well wrapped up our 30 minutes, so thank you very much, Vice President. Right, with that, we move on to Executive Committee reports. Any Executive Committee reports tonight? President Kuzma?
Hi, folks. You've seen my report to the main edition, sir, for submitting it late. I wanted to include some of the conversations that happened at the Board of Governors meeting on Friday. So if I wanted to talk about what happened at the board, then I would. I can't do that right in front of the agenda. So I sent it to you Friday. Some of the interesting things that passed was the amendments to the Board of Transportation that was proposed. Two of them passed, which was cool. This was all pretty neat. We also had a presentation from the BAF Center, which is one of the partners for the Leadership College. It's really interesting because the BAF Center itself is almost it is a residential experiential learning college of sorts. So it also seems rather redundant for us, for the UBA, to also have Leadership College. Some other interesting stuff that I'm sure Adam will note in his report was the meeting that we had with the Deputy Premier and other student associations on Monday. We're turned into a one-hour Q&A session. It became a three-hour Q&A session with the Minister. And all the other stuff we're going to talk about coming out of the rail. But overall, really interesting to hear his stance on those multiple things. Asked a question in regards to international student tuition and what the Deputy Premier's thoughts were in regards to regulation, since they're unbelievably vulnerable. They don't have access to as much student financial aid, loans. They're victims of, let's say, currency fluctuation as well. In addition to that, there's no regulation for tuition. The Deputy Premier didn't really like the idea of sharing student financial aid, kind of disappointed my question at the beginning. But he was teetering on the thought of regulation for international students' tuition. The one thing that he said he was really interested in was making it easier for international students to become permanent residents after they graduate. Because the point he made was there's no point in us kind of investing in them and having them here for only them to just go back to the countries. So I think that's a really interesting possible collaboration, and I think that's something we're going to explore with new internationalization.
Just put in. Vice President Lau.
I need to add on to that just recently, throughout the next month, President Kuzma, President, or Vice President Kellen, and myself will be working on consultation guidelines with the Dean of Students Office, which we've already IDC have an impact on the student procedure changes. One example of that is even in the draft that was just sent last week, they added a phrase about how the Latino Students Office could have a discussion with the SU if the student group is registered with the SU regarding the request for reconsideration. But even as of this morning, the conversation has shifted a little bit towards how can the SU get involved before the request for reconsideration so that it'll be easier for the students and not have to, or not so that the SU won't be in a conflicted situation where we'll have to defend the group. Rather, we'll be able to work together. So that's one thing that we're all working on.
Vice President, the Skypers are just asking if you can talk a little louder.
Okay. We're working on guidelines for consultation with the Dean of Students Office. Another thing coming up is for those of you interested in student group issues and how student group services are being run, to address some of the concerns that were raised over the past few weeks, they have a town hall that's tomorrow at 5 p.m. They have a few students register right now, but even if you haven't registered, you can still drop by. So it'll be tomorrow, 5 p.m. in the alumni room. Besides that, we also had our International Student Issues Town Hall last Friday, and that was a big success, and I can send out my takeaways from that in an email later on. And there's also a hockey game this Friday that's free for all current students if you have your one card with a U pass on it. And along with that, the first 500 students will also get a free burger. So something to look forward to. Game starts at 7. Burgers will start at 6.
Point of information? Are there veggie burgers?
Probably.
Vice President Lay.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Just a quick amendment or clarification to my council report on the SU social media. I said in a quote, I will take over the social media council on a trial basis. That is incorrect. I'm only being granted the access to it from the marketing communications department. So I'm not taking it over. I'm just trying some things out with information. So just a correction.
Thank you. Further exec reports? Seeing none. Board and committee reports? Any board or committee chairs? Seeing none. Okay, moving on to question period. Any questions? Vice President Chellen.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker?
Yes.
I believe written questions take precedence.
Point well taken. Thank you very much. There are a few written questions, in fact. So we will go down the list. And you know how much I love written questions. So thank you very much. And as always, I encourage written questions. Item 5A, there is already a response. Is the actual item... Okay, yes, item 5A. So the question is on the original order paper, and the response is on the late ads. Vice President Lay, anything to add?
I don't think Councillor Muhammad is here. It's all this.
Okay. Okay, item 5B to Vice President Woods.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I did not provide a written response to this because there wasn't a very lengthy answer. I thought I could just inform you all or the council. So if you weren't aware, the issue that Councilor Muhammad is bringing up is actually relevant to some of the things I've discussed to council about regarding international students, specifically off-campus work permits. Two Nigerian students a few years ago, they're going to the University of Regina, and they... try to get a part-time job just at Walmart, something to you know, help them out, get a little bit of additional cash flow going. They did not realize that they weren't allowed to work off campus without a permit. Just Walmart didn't say anything, which they should have. These two students had just come from Nigeria. They had no idea. The feds busted them, said, "We got to deport you now," at which point they ran away, which admittedly wasn't the best decision. But ultimately, they just wanted to continue their education, which I can understand and respect. Councilor Muhammad's question was whether or not the NCAA reaching a stance, some others are coming to a stance. Upon finding out about this, I immediately called leadership members from the Canadian Alliance of Students Associations, brought the issue up with them. We had a statement, a news statement made within the day. So on that same day, we released a statement just essentially iterating that if students were allowed to work off campus from the get-go, this wouldn't have happened, and it shouldn't have been a problem in the first place. And that's the principles that we as a students union stand behind, and that the Canadian Alliance of Student Associations stands behind. So we have made a statement, and we'll be following up with the government and continue lobbying on this issue to hopefully reflect change within the next year or so. So thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Okay, item 5C, also to Vice President Woods.
I'm going to caveat. Oh, what is the rationale? Sorry, I didn't read the question properly. Why are international students to work on campus? Well, as sad as it is, unfortunately, there are still people in Canada who think that when international students come to Canada, they're taking their jobs. So that's the first and foremost worry. It is, frankly, kind of absurd, given that, as bad as it sounds, the majority of jobs that we as students and international students would work are not jobs that the common public typically goes out of their way to get. So, ultimately, it's not the case. They wouldn't be taking anybody's jobs. They'd just simply be financing their own education. And our argument has been from the get-go that, I mean, if we're going to bring people here and going to charge them astronomical tuition rates, which we do, we should at least give them the opportunity to afford that education and earn that education on their own without having to go into large amounts of ridiculous debt and then have to go home to pay it off, especially if we want them to stay here afterwards rather than just, you know, say Canada's a bad place and leave the country. So their rationale was, again, there's Canadian concern around taking domestic people's jobs. And that's really what it comes down to, unfortunately. So,
okay. Now we will move on to oral questions. Vice President Challen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Chair of CAC. I'll direct this to the Chair of CAC. That's probably the best person. So I think elections are coming up for council and GFC. And just wondering how many positions will remain unfilled when the election is over, and where I can find more information about candidates, as well as where and when to vote.
Councillor Borden? I don't have a lot of information unless
I... just all be on the website.
I would encourage, unless Councillor Borden has anything to add, either referring to the elections website or contacting the Chief Returning Officer. I know they're still having some telephone issues up there, but I'm sure he's available by email. And I believe he has some office hours posted up on the sixth floor as well. So that's what we need. Okay. Okay. President Kuzmin.
I want to thank you, Mr. Speaker. I want to ask the Vice President of Student Life a question as to how the International Students Town Hall went on Friday.
The International Students Town Hall went extremely well. Would you like to hear about some of the questions? And if you do, let me do it really quick. I don't know how to take that. But it was a very fruitful discussion. My main goal of that town hall was to get some direction from the international students themselves about what some of their teams should work. And on top of that, it was a really good venue to be able to clarify a lot of misconceptions. There were mixed feelings, however, from the students themselves. For example, some students felt like they wanted, I guess, a more action-based town hall where they could have a takeaway and act on it right away to advocate for themselves. Where other students felt that they were just really happy to be given the opportunity to speak up and to have that student advocacy support. So coming forward, we do see a strong potential for the creation of the International Students Association so that they could have their own efforts for advocacy while the SU could still be present to hear the voices and support and do their advocacy efforts. As for the key takeaways, I'll have to find that in my inbox because I wrote them up on Friday and I can put them up to council.
Thank you. Ms. Kinda?
This question is from Council Mohammed. Can I read?
Any objection?
So this question is for Vice President Lee. So WISC is a dedicated unit that does wonderful work with sponsoring refugee students. However, the group has lost their space and sub and is unable to store their equipment. Can we use one of the vacant rooms on the sixth floor sub to store their equipment for the time being?
No.
Okay.
Oh, let me clarify. All the groups have been notified and they were spoken to in the summer. And it'd be unfair to allow one group that is given or that is receiving money, especially as a DFU, to have more space when every other club is in the same situation.
Okay.
So it's unfortunate that our WISC is unable to start their group, but so is every other group. But it's the short-term pain of the renovations for a long-term pain for all the groups will benefit.
Point of information? Do the other DFU, like, is WISC the only DFU that doesn't have its own space?
The other DFUs, they pay for space. So, if they would like to pay for space, we're hoping to go to space.
Thank you. Councillor Hodgson?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for Vice President Lay. I was curious, have the DFU representatives for the DFU task force been notified yet?
Sort of. They've all been voted, so it's a matter of just sending out that email. So it's in a draft. It's our part of the bill.
Councilor Bannister.
Thank you. So I have a question for President Kuzbu. I'm sorry, he probably knows what I'm going to ask. I'm a bit annoyed about this. But do you have any progress on the Departments of Design and Music, as well as the School of Business moving off campus to a downtown location?
Yeah, I can't comment much of it because I don't want to break confidentiality in court. However, I have asked a written question to the Vice President of Facilities and Operations about this at the upcoming GFC meeting, and if you have greater ability to disclose more information about this than I would, because I just participated in a closed session. Hopefully we can get more information. Indications I got from him is perpetual, just as a redundant question you asked us last night. But I said, well, can you provide more information? I guess I'll update everyone else. So hopefully you get some more information.
Any further questions? Councilor Graham?
Question for President Kuzbu. I was wondering if there has been any progress on, executive goals or whatever that are related to your, the entrepreneurship, nonprofit, and I'm just interested to give in the context of this, the presentation we had about the Nutrition College and all these, interesting things going through that.
So, thanks a lot for asking the question, Councilor Graham. So what we, and by we, it's primarily Vice President Student Life Lao and Vice President Lay. We've been doing is meeting up with various stakeholders who are already kind of involved in the entrepreneurship student service. So we've met with folks from Venture Mentoring Service from our alumni association. What was excellent about that meeting is they provided us with a bunch of documentation and requirements and scans of various entrepreneurship opportunities for students. Right now we're scheduled to meet up with the folks from Startup Edmonton and Make Something Edmonton. So we have two meetings slated. That's actually going to be a few weeks. And then right now it's kind of been a fact-finding mission, just trying to see what's out there, trying to get a better idea of what we can provide. Our meeting with Tech Edmonton went really, really well, actually, and they still have to send us a one major that they have to send you. Right now we've just been kind of in the exploration phase. And my goal is to hopefully in tandem with maybe a couple of councillors who are interested, like Councillor Zhang told me that he was interested last time in this kind of initiative. So if you are too, I can be showing the list, my mental list, but folks who can help me out on this. But to ideally prepare council perhaps a concept paper on what are possible things council can do for this, and hopefully have next year's potential executives pick this up and push the goal further. It's kind of my objective. So.
Thank you.
Asking, and I'm going to be on the list.
Thank you. Councillor Minarski.
This question is kind of a follow-up to Councillor Bannister's question. I was wondering, and assuming confidentiality, was there a vote held, and if so, how did you vote?
You know what? I really struggle with stuff that's taking in place in closed session. And I'm really grateful. I don't know if I can disclose that. I'll talk to the board, to the university secretaries, and see what I can disclose to council. I'll try and send a follow up.
But yeah, they hassle us for this. And they got to talk about leaking stuff because there's a huge incentive in the past time. So.
Thank you. Ms. Kinda?
Thanks. So this question is to Vice President Chilin. It's about CSL. From my understanding, that program is pretty new, right? It's a few years. Okay. So you said that there's been like a downward trend in supported funding. Do you know why that is?
Thanks for the question, and genuinely thanks for the question. I found out earlier this week how CSL was funded and where it's at, and it's actually interesting and alarming. So, for those of you that don't know, community service learning is an opportunity where, in a course, instead of writing a paper or completing a midterm or something like that, a student typically will complete a 15 or 20 hour project that meets the need of the community. So, the Edmonton Federation of Community, so the John Humphrey Center, or nonprofits here in Edmonton will say, we need help with X. Is there any way that you can send a student who's learning about this topic to come and help us? And there's something like 800 or 900 opportunities offered every year by CSL, so it's a fantastic program to help the community with what you're learning and build real applicable practical skills. CSL is funded in part by donations and in part by the Faculty of Arts. So why has funding gone down? Number one, donations, from my understanding, have gone down. Number two, it was started initially with something called an endowment, a big pool of funds that would generate income or generate money that could be used for the operation of CSL. That endowment started about 9 years ago and came to the end of its life in about a year. And so the pen motion that the arts is spreadsheet to describe it is CSL's group, like this. Its primary source of funding is dead in 2 years. The second issue is despite CSL courses being offered across faculties, it's only funded by the Faculty of Arts. No other faculties fund CSL, even though it's available to students across faculties, and that there are ALES courses, phys ed courses, science courses that have a CSL component. Arts funds all of it. Arts has been cut to the point that some of their departments can't have telephones. So I think that's another pretty good reason on why the CSL program is really a risk.
Thank you. With that, we've hit our time frame, and apologies for this. I'll get it back up in a second. This device has a timer on it, and once the timer goes off, it goes up and so on, but we'll get it going once as soon as the projector warms back up. In the meantime, that is 15 minutes, so we will end question period and move on to general orders. On our main order paper, we have item 7A, and again, I will read out exactly how it's going to sound here. Hodgson moves that Students' Council approve the 2012-2013 draft auditor's report and year-end financial statements. Does anyone need me to repeat that? Everyone's got that? Okay, perfect. Are the Councillor Hodgson, are the statements attached, or where are...
I emailed them out to everybody.
Okay. Do we have a seconder for this motion? Councillor Bannister, thank you very much. Councillor Hodgson to introduce.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I will try to go through some of this. So, sorry it's not on your order paper. I emailed out the draft auditor's report with the financial statements attached on Saturday, I think Saturday. So you should have all gotten that email in your inbox. I received an updated copy of the financial statements from Peter Ta, manager of the accounting department at the SU. Like I said, an email, that updated version just reflects a few wording changes. Is that how much time I have?
No, I'm sorry, this wasn't reset from before. It's an introduction, so there's no real time limit as long as you stay on the introduction.
Yeah, so I'll maybe just quickly go through what this report means. First off, have the auditor's letter to president and members of the Students' Union and the Students' Union Council. That's essentially the only real relevant bit is his opinion at the end, saying getting stolen money, more or less. The financial statements present fairly in all material respects the financial position of the Students' Union at the end of April 30th, 2013.
and the results of its operations and its cash flows for the year, then ended in accordance with Canadian accounting standards for nonprofit organizations. So the audit came back clean. There's nothing of interest really. Straightforward. The second part in the draft report is just a. They at the same time that the auditor, who is our auditor, is KPMG, audit the students' union. They also audit the student involvement. Yeah, students involvement endowment fund. Which is, I believe, where a lot of the scholarships come from. It's just a big, big endowment fund that we use the interest generated off it to build up scholarships and such. It is audited as, because it's an endowment fund, it's kind of treated separately in financial terms. It is a part of the SU, but so that second letter is just saying endowment fund, there's nothing going on there. Everything is presented fairly in all material respects, financial position of the foundation. So, again, pretty clean. The third thing is an independence letter addressed to Mr. Cody Hodgson that says that essentially just says that KPMG has no affiliation with the SU, they're not in bed together, or there's no secret relationships going on or something. They are independent to our organization. So we brought in an independent auditor to audit our organization. The last letter. Is a letter to the management, so just identifying some managerial areas where either controls could be, I don't think it's even necessarily controls can be improved. This is some real technical stuff. It's like, if you want to talk about it, this is my jam. I love it. But yeah, so that's essentially it. I won't go into any of the I won't go into any of the more specifics there. Afterwards, in the report are the financial statements, which feel free to flip through. I'm not going to break those down, mainly because I only have a limited understanding of how they work. But if you do want to talk about them, if you have any specific questions about them, feel free to ask me. And I do have a few paper copies of the audit findings report if anybody wants to see if this is kind of designed for the managers from the managerial perspective, so it includes some of those more technical questions as well as just the fact they found nothing kind of thing.
Thank you. Councillor Hodgson, is that document public, the draft report?
This thing right...
The report we're approving?
The one I sent out?
Yeah.
I believe it's...
Okay, public. Just because we're ex-camera, I'm assuming we are. I'm assuming they're public. If so, I would just ask, since they're not attached here, they should probably be, if you wouldn't mind sending them to Nicole after, and we should append them to this so that if members of the public want to see the approval process, they can. As well, Councillor Hodgson, go ahead.
I just wanted to add two more things.
Oh, sure, go ahead.
To my introduction. So we did make a motion at audit committee to recommend, but my bad, I didn't give enough notice for that meeting to actually occur, so... That's why you don't see audit committee recommendation on this. We just did make that recommendation on our meeting last week and then got enough notice. The other bit I wanted to add was, the reason we need council, the reason the draft is there, draft until council approves them. The auditor is actually still on the hook for anything that happens up until the point we approve them. So if Petros goes and embezzles $1 million, today, the auditor's actually on the hook for it, that we currently hired, but if he does it tomorrow, after we approve this, it'll just come up next year. So.
Thank you. So as I mentioned, if we could, we'll have those documents put onto the agenda package. We'll have those appended after. I'm assuming all of you have seen the email that Councillor Hodgson has referred to. That being said, again, in the future, and not necessarily directed at this particular motion, but in general, I strongly recommend you attach documents to the actual order paper. to ensure, A, both that every counselor has seen it in the event that not everyone has seen their email or whatnot, and B, also so that members of the public can see it if they're reading it. That being said, if all members of council have read over the documents and are comfortable with approving them without seeing them, I have no problem with that. That being said, you're entitled to see them, and so if you haven't seen them or you're concerned that they aren't here, rise on a point of personal privilege, and I will take it from there. But barring that, we will proceed with debate. Is there any debate on this motion? Councillor Hodgson?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Just say one thing really quick, but nothing really came up. It's a good audit.
Further debate? Councillor Graham?
A question for Councillor Hodgson. So we get audited every year, or like we audit ourselves every year?
So again, we're in debate, so we'll throw that question on the floor, and Councillor Hodgson could either take it later or give some sort of nod and have a speaking period without actually taking a speaking turn, which is efficient, so. Vice President Chellen.
That nod suffices.
Okay. Further debate? President Kuzma.
Yeah, so just on page 933 on the audit, it's interesting, I never noticed we represent approximately 41,000 of the graduate students.
Is it statements you're talking about?
No, it's page 933 on the financial statements on the CSA.
Further debate? Vice President Chellen?
I'm going to put on the page 3.
Yep.
Well, sorry, it's. Put in front of the page 3.
Yep.
I assume the S. Is the SU able to make amendments to, is SU Council able to make amendments to a document submitted by an auditor?
We aren't able to amend the document itself because it's not our document to amend. Councillor Hodgson, do you have any other clarification on that? Or?
I would say if there was an issue with the report, we would bring it to the auditor. We wouldn't make an adjustment ourselves. We can flag that, contact KPMG, and get them to look into that and resolve that.
So what I would recommend if there were concerns is you would do as if a motion came from a committee. You could do a motion to refer to a committee, refer it to audit committee, and then have audit committee liaise with the auditors to make any necessary adjustments or receive any other information or whatever the case may be. Further debate? President Kuzma? Point of parliamentary.
I'll just throw a question before. What's the urgency or time sensitivity with the audits, if there is any?
Councillor Speakman?
I'd like to defer my speaking turn to Councillor Hodgson.
Okay.
Thank you. like I mentioned, it's just actually the fact that the auditor is still on the hook for anything that comes up. So technically, they are still in our employment. We are still, and they're responsible if anything happens. So until this report is approved, they need to be kind of monitoring what's going on. So I'm assuming we're still paying the money kind of thing. The process is complete. It's just, as soon as council approves this, we end our relationship with the auditor. But so I guess technically it's not time sensitive. But I'll defer to Josh maybe here.
I might be wrong, but I think in bylaw until October 31st.
I'll pretend there is a point of parliamentary inquiry attached to that to see if I can find
information on that.
So, bylaw 3000, section 2.2 says Students' Council shall approve each year's fiscal. Students' Council shall approve each fiscal year's audited financial statements before the conclusion of the ensuing fiscal year. So I believe, Vice President Lay, our fiscal year is May to April, is that correct?
April 30th.
So our requirement would be to have these statements approved by April 30th, 2014. Further debate? Councillor Speakman?
Yeah. Just food for thought. If our fiscal year is that long and there's this
threshold to the thing where, like, if we approve it today, then the auditor's off the hook for stuff that happens now until the next audit. Maybe in the future, it would be good to move the audit forward closer to the spring so that we get any nefarious executives. They won't be able to do that in their term.
I'm going to pretend there is a point of parliamentary inquiry on there, and Councillor Hodgson may jump in on this as well. He might be on the same track as I. But I will remind Council that this is approving the 2012-2013 audited financial statements and not the 2013-2014 audited financial statements. I will leave it there if anyone else wants to debate further than me. Further debate? Councillor Hodgson? Yeah.
Maybe I'll just, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'll just clarify on timeline a little bit there. So how this generally works is in March-ish, audit committee will approach an auditor to bring them in and contact them about doing CSU's year-end audit. Nothing can actually start until our fiscal year ends. After that, it takes our accounting department, I think, a time period of about 2 months to consolidate all. They have to bring in the financial statements from all of the businesses and departments of the SU and actually build consolidated year-end financial statements that they can then provide to the auditor. So there is a significant amount of work that goes into this. Like, realistically, the actual auditing process, I think, starts sometime early August, late July, and then that takes a month to 2 months-ish. So we're a little later here. I believe the audit was ready probably about a month before. But again, there's some issues with turnover and audit committee every year. So generally about now is the earliest, maybe mid-September we could push, like if we're really on our game, get this done by. But it does take a significant period of time to put this together. And then again, like time-sensitive-wise, this is not time-sensitive, but like we do need to approve the financial the auditor's report at some point. Like we continue our relationship with them, which is kind of odd. Like they've done the job they've been requested of. So, yeah.
Further debate? Seeing no further debate, we will call to question. Again, I'll read the phrasing out because it was a little bit unclear. Hodgson, can't remember the seconder, but it was on the minutes, moves that Students' Council approve the 2012-2013 draft auditor's report and year-end financial statements. All those in favor? All those opposed? That motion carries. Carries either way. Do you want that noted, Councilman? Okay. And again, a reminder, you're abstaining and you don't want it noted. You don't even have to tell me. You just don't want to vote. So, okay. So that motion carries. And with that, I believe we are at the end of our order paper. So I'd look favorably upon a motion to adjourn. Vice President Lay, Councillor Grahan, thank you very much. All those in favor? Opposed? That motion carries. And we will do attendance, as always. President Kuzmu.
Vice President.
Vice President Chellen. Vice President. He's not here. No. More than I need to know. Vice President Woods.
Present.
Vice President Lay. Vice President Lau. Governor Kelly. Councillor Battelle. Councillor Borden. Councillor Mills. Councillor Hanwell. Councillor Bannister.
Present.
Councillor Schiavone. Councillor Mohammed. Ms. Kinda for Councillor Mohammed.
Present.
Councillor Grokey. Councillor Grokey, I think, is still here. Yeah,
yeah.
He's still here. Councillor Minarski.
Present.
Councillor Valdez.
Present.
Councillor Corbett.
Yeah, present.
Councillor Redman.
Yeah.
Councillor Hamid. Councillor Morris.
Present.
I am.
Councillor Nguyen.
No one!
Nguyen, is she still here? Yep. I think. Let's see. Yeah, she's here. Okay, thank you. Councillor Champagne. Councillor Speakman. Councillor Hodgson.
Yeah.
Councillor Huang. Councillor Zhang. Councillor Grahan. Councillor Binchik. Councillor Douglas.
Yep.
That's everybody. Okay, folks, we will see you in 2 weeks. Thank you very much. We are adjourned at 8:39. Josh and Eric, I believe. Yeah.
No, I just found that the toxic was going to be a little bad.
Okay.